Gentlemen, welcome to a regular commission meeting of Chelan County Board of Directors. Today's June 4th, 2018. All five commissioners are president. They may as well be. It'd be a definite improvement in the organization. Are present, and that gives us our quorum. We just finished a board workshop and are entering into our regular session. And I would like to remind you, if you have a cell phone, please position it so it does not disturb the meeting. And earlier in the year, I commented that if your cell phone went off, we were going to ship it somewhere. And I've decided it will be a random address in Albuquerque, and good luck finding it. With that being said, I'd like to ask Dave Parkhill to lead us in our Pledge of Allegiance and our safety minute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, good morning. My name is Dave Parkhill, Safety Training Program Administrator here at the district, and I wanted to talk today about the importance of buckling up. And it's amazing, 90% of Americans buckle up, but there's still 10% of drivers and passengers, or 27 million people, that don't buckle up every year. Now, some good news was in 2016, 14,500 lives were saved by the use of seatbelts in crashes. And the last couple weeks, there's been a campaign called the Click It or Ticket campaign, and the USDOT, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, as well as local law enforcement agencies, get together and have a campaign. Maybe you've seen some of the commercials on TV or radio ads. Now, we're going to go back a few years. In 1968, our family had a Ford Galaxy station wagon, wood grain paneling, and I don't believe it had a seatbelt in the back. So if my dad had to slam on the brakes, I got the forearm here, and it usually caught me right about here. That was our restraining device.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
And we looked like the Griswolds going down the road. Goes, oh, I got you here. So, well, things have changed, and that's a good thing. Some of the data, pretty startling. Over 10,500 deaths happened in 2016 by people not wearing a seatbelt. And had those people, 5 years or more, had they all worn their seatbelt, there would have been an additional 2,500 lives saved. Pretty amazing. And you'd think we're in this day and age now where everybody would buckle up, but unfortunately we don't. Young males, 18 to 34, account for 44% of all traffic-related deaths by not wearing a seatbelt. So with that in mind, the consequences of not wearing a seatbelt. Well, obviously, if you don't, you could get ejected through the car. Now, one of the classes that I teach here at the district is forklift training. And I tell our forklift drivers, I don't care if you're going 2 feet to pick up a pallet or a lot farther than that to pick up a bin, you need to wear a seatbelt. Two reasons. If somebody were to step right out in front of you, you didn't see him, and you slammed on your brakes, you could get ejected and hit the mast. Or even worse, if you were lifting a bin that was too heavy and the forklift were to tip over, it's going to keep you inside the cab, because most deaths in forklift happens when people jump out and they get crushed by the overhead guard. And so that's number one. Number two, airbags. I believe there's a false sense of security. Well, I have an airbag, I'll be fine. But what they show is the injuries from airbags are even worse if you're not properly secured with a seatbelt. And then finally, improper use. People might put the seatbelt under their arm or what have you, and that's showing even more injuries if you are in a crash. So what can you do? Well, buckle up. Besides a $124 fine, if you do get caught not wearing a seatbelt, it's going to keep you and the people in your vehicles safe. And here's a good life lesson for young drivers. You get in the vehicle, you get your buddies in the back, they choose not to buckle up. It's important to say, you know what, before we leave, you need to buckle up. Or if you have any passengers in your vehicle that you don't normally have, remind them, we're not going anywhere until you buckle up. It's because I care about you. Any questions?
No, just a comment. Having son is law enforcement. He has some really interesting stories about people sneaking their seatbelts on as you're approaching the vehicle. You know, and they do tuck them behind them, and so they just kind of tug on them, and that belt pops up. And it's like, oh, restraint didn't work, obviously. But no, it's an interesting thing. But, Dave, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day. Thanks, yep. Dave.
Welcome to staff and our visitors and other people from other organizations that have agreed to come and present to us today. I'd just like to extend a welcome to you. I'm glad you're here and looking forward to the information that you will be sharing with us. Let's take a look at the agenda, please. Any additions, changes, transfers, corrections? Hearing none, we will move on to item four. Mr. Wright, please.
Well, we're fortunate today to be visited by Brad Swatsky and Mike Paoli from the Energy Northwest organization. I invite them to come up to the table. I'll just take a moment to introduce them. Brad is the relatively new, newly announced Chief Executive Officer at Energy Northwest. But we've known him for a long time as the Chief Nuclear Officer as well as the Chief Operating Officer. At Energy Northwest, I had the pleasure of working with Brad for many years when I was at Bonneville, and I have to say he was a part of a very significant and important turnaround at the nuclear power plant there, so much so that we invited him to come speak at Bonneville about how to achieve operational excellence, and recall that operational excellence is one of our four values here. So we're pleased to have him here in his new role, and I believe we might be the first stop on his tour of customers. And so we're
first stop on the tour. That's correct. So good. Well, thank you, Steve. I appreciate being here. Thanks. Thanks for the time to be able to come and get a chance to meet. I've met most of the team at some point or another, but I appreciate the opportunity in the new role to have a discussion today. As you noted, Steve, I've had the good fortune myself of getting to work for years, Steve and I working together in his role at Bonneville, and they always a great supporter of helping us out relative to what we needed in support of what was doing what was right from their perspective in supporting Energy Northwest and Columbia, and I'm very grateful for that. So today my intent was to just kind of cover at a high level, and as Steve and I spoke about, you know, I understand you guys don't take our power, so a lot of this is geared towards that. I'm going to move through that relatively quickly. I think I'll spend a little more time talking about energy services development side, because that's where I think there are opportunities, or I would like to, you know, encourage you if there's things you think we can do to provide support or help with, to look to take advantage of those. So with that, I'm going to jump into my presentation here. I think it's over my shoulder. Right, so everyone can see it up there. I'll start with the just a real quick on my background. I came from Xcel Energy in Minnesota. I grew up in Minnesota, my wife and I both actually, and I worked at a plant there, Monticello Nuclear Plant, which was in my hometown actually where I grew up, which was never by design. Life just worked out that way. I spent 29 years with Xcel, most of it at Monticello. My highest position there was plant manager. For about 18 months, I was down in Red Wing, Minnesota, a pressurized water, which was also part of our company. I spent about 18 months there at Prairie Island before getting the opportunity to come out to Energy Northwest, and I've been out here a little over 7.5 years now. So looking at after my move, we've also made some move with the team members. If we take a look at the team, I'll go through. I think a lot of you had a chance to meet these individuals, but I'll touch on them quickly. Grover Heddle has been promoted to our Chief Nuclear Officer. Grover was our Vice President of Operations. I've known Grover for many, many years. He's got a varied background also in the nuclear industry. So he's moved up, taking over that position. Brent Ridge, who has been our VP for, has been our Chief Financial Officer. As part of restructure, when I got the position, I moved Energy Services Development reporting underneath Brent. I'm sure a lot of you know Brent. He's been involved with Public Power for many, many years himself, both himself and his mother, Judy, I'm sure very familiar to all of you. Brent's experience with Public Power and his experience as a chief financial officer, we thought was a great fit for what we're trying to accomplish with energy services development. And I'll talk a little more about that in a minute, but That's a part of the business. We'd like to see that side grow. It keeps it separate from the nuclear side. Grover Heddle has full responsibility for all nuclear. Brent will have all of the energy services development side, so that the two of them are completely separate with organizations managing them. Bob Schutz, who had been our plant general manager, Bob's been with us about 4 years. Bob is a retired Navy submarine captain. He'd been in the Navy for 30 years prior to actually going to work for IMPO, the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations. And we got him on loan several years ago, and we are looking to shore up our leadership team. We got him on a reverse loan for a while. He liked the area, and we were fortunate enough to be able to convince him to stay with us. He was plant general manager. He's now moved up to the vice president of operations. Alex Javorek's been our vice president of engineering on the Columbia side. He's been that. He joined probably about a year after I got here, about 6.5 years. Alex has been with us, a very, very much equipment first kind of guy. That's what I always liked about Alex. Take care of the plant, invest in the plant, invest in your equipment. It's interesting, in a pre-meeting today, Steve and I got a chance to talk a little bit about what you're doing here relative to investing, taking the long range approach, if you will, to investing in your equipment and your assets and your resources. Certainly, coming from the nuclear industry, I'm a big believer in that in the long term, that always pays for itself. And Alex is a big driver of that at our site. Scott Vance is our new general counsel. We got him from TVA, so he's got a lot of experience working with government bodies, if you will, relative to generating companies. And he actually is from Idaho, him and his wife originally, and they wanted to get back closer to family they have in Idaho. So he just joined us about 3 months ago. Dave Brown's our new plant general manager. Dave's about a 28-year employee of Energy Northwest. We were very pleased to get the chance to promote him. And then finally, Don Queen right now is the interim energy services and development general manager. Jim Gaston had held that position. Jim retired a couple months ago. Don was actually a retired employee from energy services development. We convinced him to come back and help us out for a few months while Brent and his team are posting that position and interviewing and starting this week, actually conducting their interviews to hire someone from the long term. So to that end, I'll talk a little bit about energy services and development and what we're trying to accomplish there. If you look at our focus areas, you know, we think we offer technical services that are available for different areas where we have expertise. Certainly purchasing and contracts is an area that we've been working with general managers, trying to, if you will, put together a consortium of PUDs in the Northwest to try to use our purchasing power together to try to leverage that. In an effort to help cost. It's kind of modeled after what we had done in the nuclear side with our Utility Service Alliance group, where a bunch of single-unit plants got together to purchase together to try to get, if you will, some fleet gains from those purchases. Project development is an area we're interested in. I'll talk in a moment about a Horton Rapids project that we're doing relative to solar. I will tell you this, though, as both Brent and I are aligned on the fact that we're ensuring as we get into this that it's within our wheelhouse. Okay, there are things I think that we do have the ability to get involved with at the right level. I think historically sometimes our eyes, as the saying, we're bigger than our stomachs as far as, catching a shiny object and thinking, hey, that looks interesting, but maybe not was outside of our area of expertise. So we will focus on staying within that. Operations and maintenance of plants. I'll take a look at the plants we do recently. We think this is our greatest opportunity. You know, operating and maintaining plants, whether they're nuclear, hydro, wind farms, is an area where we have experience. And anywhere any of our members are looking for any support in that area, we have great interest in being involved in that. And we recently, in the last couple of years, have taken on hydro for Tioughton and also for Portland. The city of Portland just recently took over managing a couple hydro utilities for them, or hydro plants for them. Non-nuclear generation assets, that's really what I just discussed around our area and hydro and our wind farm. I think people are aware we are staying engaged with UAMPS as far as a small modular reactor as a potential operator and maintainer of that somewhere down the road. If you haven't been following them, they are still out looking to get, frankly, their electricity subscribers for their electricity. They've got work to do there, yet we're really in a monitor mode from our position right now until such a time that they would actually say, hey, they got the subscribers, they're off, they're going. Then we look at what support, and I'd put that under, development innovative. Non-nuclear projects, I mentioned already, Nine Canyon Wind. I know Steve and I were talking. That's the one area you guys just take a small sliver from, if you will, from Nine Canyon. We also have Packwood Lake Hydroelectric, White Bluff Solar, which is really an experimental solar, very small. Horn Rapids would be a much larger facility if that gets up and running. And as I noted, Tioughton and Portland are two areas we took over recently and where we manage and operate and maintain those facilities. Horn Rapids Solar Storage, I'll just note right now, as you can see, is first-of-a-kind photovoltaic solar facility. We're actually working with IBEW 77 to make that happen. They want to use it as a training facility. The city of Richland has shown interest in having the power to use as a carbon-free power. And right now, frankly, we're in the final stages. It's going to really come down to whether or not the city of Richland decides to buy in on that. They're looking at the cost of the power. They'll be the final decision makers. We're actually cautiously optimistic. A couple months ago, I wasn't as optimistic that it would make it happen, but I feel much more optimistic about this taking place, but we'll know more in the next month or so. Columbia, I'll move through this relatively quickly, but you know, as everyone I think knows, boiling water reactor been online since 1984. We have our license extension through 2043. Our output is 1,207 megawatts electric. We've increased that by about 50 megawatts electric over the last 5 years through some minor modification and fixing long-term equipment challenges. And you can see the stats there as far as electricity that's being used in the Northwest. Go ahead, Michael. I will note one thing that we are proud of with Columbia is with the increased generation. We've also worked hard to decrease our cost. You know, we recognize the challenge to Bonneville, and although you don't off-take our power, we all obviously have a stake in what's going on with Bonneville Power and the economic challenges there from the business units they have, including us, as I consider for Columbia. And we've worked hard over the last 7 years to continue to decrease our cost of power, and we're not stopping here. We've got work to do. We've got a plan laid out over the next 10 years to 2028 that continues every single year with this reduction in cost. And actually, our executive board in August is going to take a look at this, and I think we're going to, my guess is when that's done, we're going to commit ourselves to being even more aggressive relative to our cost. We've gotten here by increasing our generation capability, increasing the performance of the plant, and reducing headcount by approximately 150 people over the last 7 years through normal attrition. And right now, as the schedule's laid out, we would reduce by another 100 over the next decade. But as I said, I believe we're going to get more aggressive with that. Also, in regional savings, I think for the region, the debt restructuring, I'm sure you're aware of what's been done there from debt restructure, taking on lower cost debt, leveraging Energy Northwest and our facilities, has helped decrease the cost here by $2.1 billion and given us $2.1 billion in regional savings over 12 years based on that. Go ahead, Mike. Just a quick note on, you know, nuclear energy, 19%. We're big believers in it. We're believing because of the carbon-free baseload aspect of it. Having said that, we've got plenty of focus areas left yet with Energy Northwest. The four I got right now in front of me, first and foremost, is the Columbia Generating Station. We've faced our shared equipment challenges over the last 2 years. We've had three unplanned shutdowns in the last 2 years, all three of them equipment-based, one of them an internal piece of equipment on a valve failure, two of them coming about with challenges with transmission systems. So we've got work there to do. From the transmission system perspective, Bonneville and us are working very closely together to determine where those challenges are. They've been very supportive, and our teams have worked closely together to go after and make fixes as necessary. But we need to continue to get better and drive that. It's unacceptable in that case to have those three unexpected challenges to production from equipment. So there continues to be a focus area. I noted also that decreasing cost continues. I believe we need to get even more aggressive than we've been relative to looking to support Bonneville by their 2028, where the contracts come due. We want to make sure that we're doing our part to support them in that cost perspective. Generation flexibility. Steve's well aware of this one. When I first got here, Mark and I, we talked a lot with Steve and the team about, if you will, load dispatching Columbia Generating Station, the effects it has with moving a power plant up and down in power. And it does have some challenges associated with it. But as we look for a niche for Columbia Generating Station beyond just the pure cost of megawatts electric and base load, the other opportunity we do provide to Bonneville is we are dispatchable at some level if it's managed appropriately. We are revisiting. We had created an agreement with Bonneville as to how we'd manage the plant to minimize the load dispatching. I spent time talking with Exelon last week, which is the largest owner of nuclear plants in the country. They have a lot of merchant. And frankly, they've started doing a lot of load dispatching with their merchant plants, you know, because we're all aware that the cost of power is going negative right now at different times during the year. And from Bonneville's perspective, they're challenged with not being able to dispatch wind without some penalty in some of these other areas. So we're trying to figure out what can we do to make ourselves, if you will, give ourselves more things in support of what's going on here in the Northwest. And if we can dispatch more often, that would be a benefit to all the ratepayers here in the Northwest. So we're looking for what we can do. We're revisiting. We're going to be benchmarking Exelon to see what they're doing, to see if there's a little more flexibility than maybe we built in originally. And finally, I talked about energy services and development growth. We want to grow the operational side in particular of that business, because the more growth we have there in generating and operating plants of any type helps take cost away from Columbia again, because Columbia takes on 95% of the overhead in our company right now. So if we can build more hydro, more wind farm, operating and maintaining it for utilities that are looking for someone to supply that service, we can offset that cost that's going 95% right now to Columbia. So having said that, Steve, it wasn't quite 10 minutes. I pushed as hard as I could to get us through that. I'll stop here and take whatever time you would like relative to any questions or comments you have for us.
Commission, comments, questions? Ann.
Oh, so Brad and Mike, thanks for coming. Happy to see you in the position you're in, Brad. I served on the Energy Northwest Board for 11 years, worked with Brad quite a bit over that time. And what I really appreciate about Brad is that I could ask him a question and I'd always get a direct answer.
Thank you.
Pretty real straightforward, and that's what we need. I appreciate that. So with that, I expected to see on focus areas, and we don't have time really to go mm-hmm. into this now, but I expected waste storage to be on there as one of the challenges, one of the focus areas. I know Department of Energy is paying fines to a number of facilities because they are not holding up their end of the deal of taking waste. Oh. So we are building up waste. We have been for many years. Mm-hmm. That's a concern of mine. And when you stop people on the street and ask them about nuclear power, their number one concern is what's happening with the waste.
So number one, Ann, that's a great comment. That was two things. First of all, thank you for your support. You've always been very, and I'm very appreciative of that. Secondly, that is a great point. Mike, let's take that. Let's add that to this discussion, actually. You are spot on. As a matter of fact, in my previous role as chief nuclear officer, and I just recently gave that up in my new role, I was with Nuclear Energy Institute. They have restarted, if you will, an initiative to get Yucca Mountain going again, and I was one of two CNOs that asked to sit on that board. So we are completely aligned with you. We understand that one of our biggest challenges in nuclear is that question about that waste. We think the administration now is such, there is financing that is taking place that is working through Congress. It's got to get through the Senate. It's been through the House. That earmarks money now for revisiting and starting to get the ball rolling again, if you will, for long-term storage in a singular place. And certainly, you know, we all believe in our portion of it is Yucca Mountain is the place where we've invested the money. There's been a tremendous amount of investment. We believe it's the right place. It's the right solution. So, that is rolling. As an industry, we're focused on that. You are absolutely right on with that. And, Mike, let's add that to my presentation. That's a great suggestion, and I'm going forward to make sure I touch on that. But that's what's going on with the industry. NEI is off and running. There's money that's gone through the House. There's a similar bill in the Senate. You know, certainly we are working to get those both pushed through and signed off. We believe the administration that's in place today would be very supportive of that.
It sounds like it from what I read. That's great. Yeah. That's good news. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
I'd like you. To validate that our surveys show that waste storage is the number one public mm-hmm. concern out there. Nope. So you're right on
it
target.
Is.
A lot
it
of
is.
Folks don't know, and it's a side bit to the issue, but we like to add that the waste we have stored on site can stay there in those concrete and steel casks, 185-ton casks, for 100 years if it needs to before it needs to be replaced. So it is safe on site.
People need to be reassured.
Yes.
It is, but... from a national interest perspective, I'm a big believer in single point storage, and a lot of money has been funneled into that, and it's time to to finish that. So we'll add that to the presentation. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that anything that's been, any question that's been raised about Columbia Generating related to waste has been a paperwork issue, but never the handling of the materials. And I just think that's really important. And that's been corrected as well. But yeah. There's not been a problem in terms of public safety, and that's to everyone's credit and hard work.
Yeah, we have a solid team with a solid product. To Mike's point, I have full confidence of the safety as it is today. I just think long-term it's in our best interest to, and from a cost perspective and management, to get it to a single point storage.
Quick question. Are we still sending high-level waste to the salt caves in New Mexico? Is any of our waste going there?
No, it's not. No, we are not.
Okay.
At this point, that's a... Jim Conca. That's a big Jim Conca thing. He's pushing for it. He wants it, but not yet. But yeah, to give him credit, he's relentless.
I was going to say, I bet if persistence has anything
to do, that's right.
He will achieve. Right.
Yes.
For those who don't know, Jim Conca is a local geophysicist and nuclear scientist in the Tri-Cities area.
Delightful presenter as well.
Yes
he is.
Very
yes.
active on the speaking circuit.
Yeah. Any other thoughts or questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good luck with your tour, and looking forward to seeing you both at meetings.
Thank you so very much. Appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you
for their time. I will also just quickly let you know we have partnered with Energy Northwest. They provided funding support for the E3 study that we did on the least cost approach to carbon emissions. We'll be continuing to work with them on those kinds of issues as we approach the next legislative session.
Great.
Thank you, Brad.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Item number six, five, excuse me. I already checked off five. We need to get there first, though. Item five, please.
I want to invite Michelle Smith and Felicity Saberhagen to come up. We have a presentation following up on our previous discussions about the future of the Aranda River Park operations.
Good morning, Commissioners. Michelle Smith, Director of Hydro Licensing and Compliance.
Felicity Saberhagen, Business Advisor.
Okay, thank you. I will be discussing the first four items on the agenda today, and then Felicity will be covering the framework related to the four long-term operating options evaluated by the district staff. I'd also like to point out that today in our audience, we are honored to have the Port of Douglas County Commissioners, Commissioner Jim Huffman, Commissioner Alan Lubsack, and Commissioner Mark Spurgeon, as well as Port Executive Director Lisa Parks. At the end of our presentation, we would like to give the Port an opportunity to provide additional comments and information. Staff is not asking the Board to make any decisions today. The purpose of this presentation is to bring additional information forward and continue framing the district's options and recreational obligations as we respond to the Port of Douglas County's request for the PUD to take over operation and maintenance of Arondo River Park. So what is the current issue? The Port of Douglas County has been majority owner and the responsible operator of Arondo River Park for nearly 46 years. In 1972, the Port built the park on approximately 3.6 acres, utilizing state grant funding from RENA facilities, adding a restroom, picnic shelter, parking lot, swim beach, and other amenities and infrastructure all located on the Port's property. The Port's original impetus for creating a park in this location was to prepare docks and loading facilities for possible barge navigation for shipping wheat up and down the Columbia River. In the mid to late 1970s, the district began putting together Exhibit R recreation plans, a requirement of our hydro licenses under the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. As part of our Rocky Reach recreation plan, the district purchased parcels adjacent to and north of the park, which expanded the park from 3.6 to 5 acres. The PUD funded the installation of a lawn area, gazebo, and other small improvements, mostly on land owned by the district. A 1979 operating and lease agreement, still in place today, spells out terms whereby the Port is solely responsible for continued administration, operation, and maintenance of the entire park, and leases the district's 1.4 acres for the expanded 5-acre park. The agreement acknowledges both the port and the PUD's commitments to recreation for the Arundel community and visitors. Originally, during the Rocky Reach recreation planning phase in about 1975, only the PUD's 1.4 acres was brought into the FERC license. It wasn't until 1991 that a revised recreation plan brought the entire park into the PUD's FERC license project boundary. Over the years, the district has been a minority landowner and it has had little involvement with the Rondo River Park operations. The port's desire for the PUD to take over full operations and, or provide greater financial assistance requires an understanding of existing agreements and a look at the port and PUD regulatory obligations. Since the port's request last fall for the PUD to take over the operation of the park, the port and the PUD have worked together to develop an interim 2018 operation plan that allowed the park to open on April 1st this year. Additionally, a park condition assessment was completed by the PUD in March. The port's RCO grant funding and PUD's license obligations have been reviewed, and the 1979 lease and operating agreement has been reviewed for intent and any future opportunity for operations going forward. So what are the legal obligations for the port and PUD? Starting with the 1979 lease and operating agreement, as I mentioned, the PUD leases the 1.4 acres to the port for the purposes of the park for the duration of the existing license and any future licenses. The port commits combined the port and PUD property to be used for recreational purposes under the Rocky Reach license, and the port committed to operate at its sole expense and to work collaboratively with the PUD to develop a management plan. The port can withdraw from operating the park on 183 days written notice. The annual management plan that was intended as part of the agreement was to provide an operating and management plan depicting how the port would fulfill its obligations to administer, operate, and maintain the park. The terms included the possibility of joint funding for management activities and capital funding. In 2014, the port completed a comprehensive capital plan improvement plan for Arundel River Park. The PUD supported this planning effort by providing $10,000 in funding support towards its development. The plan states, the purpose of the plan is to document the port's intent and commitment to maintaining Arundel River Park. The plans provide staff and public officials guidance for the current and future use and enjoyment of the park for local residents and visitors. The plan was to be used to help the port secure grant funding or long-term bond sale revenue by approaching the needs of the park from a long-term planning perspective, and numerous capital improvement items were summarized in the plan. We could find no evidence of annual management plans or annual budget reporting for the park from the port as contemplated in the 1979 agreement. The PUD's current recreation plan, the entire park is listed within the PUD's project boundary, as I mentioned. However, the PUD's obligation can only be tied to areas where we have the rights and control. The port's land ownership and RCO recreation commitments make this difficult and complicate PUD's involvement. The FERC approved our 2010 recreation plan with the statement that the PUD is only obligated to ensure operation maintenance of the 1.4 acres we own. Lastly, the port has relied on state grant funding for capital improvements for years, which ties them to recreation obligations to the park forever. Last fall, the port and the PUD discussed an option whereby the port would transfer ownership of their land to the PUD, which could have provided value to the district in exchange for taking over the park, as well as giving the PUD the property rights and control as needed under our FERC license. However, we've learned since then that the port's RCO commitments encumber the site in perpetuity, and this took that option off of the table. The port has options it can take with the RCO, the Recreation Commission Office. However, the PUD is not eligible for RCO grant funding and would not be able to participate in those arrangements. I'd like to point out that under its FERC license, the PUD is required to provide a level of recreational development for public utilization of PUD hydro project waters and adjacent lands for recreational purposes, so far as consistent with proper operation and economics of the projects. The PUD's recreation legacy and commitment to parks is evidenced by the number of parks within the Rocky Reach Reservoir. We've provided this slide as well as the large graphic here to show that on the Rocky Reach Reservoir alone, the PUD operates and maintains several parks, which includes 387 acres of park lands, 242 campsites, and 11 boat launch lanes. Arundel River Park is 5-acre, one-lane boat launch, and moorage facilities, of which the PUD owns 1.3 acres. So relatively small compared to the distance of other parks close by and the total amount of park acreages that we take care of within the reservoir. We wanted to give you an update on 2018 operations. The park, as I mentioned, opened on April 1. We jointly put together with the port a 2018 management plan. We are sharing the cost for janitorial grounds maintenance is approximately $50,000. The PUD share is $25,000. The PUD completed a condition assessment. We made some high priority safety and code improvements in order to open the park. We spent about $70,000 on those improvements as well as the condition assessment plan. The port continues to remain the primary operator and point of contact for the public and the park users. They operate the water system, they removed the fuel sign and dispenser, and worked with the DOT to change highway signs. The PUD is continuing to gain Arundel community comments through June 20th. We currently have a postcard and a mailer that went out to the Arundel community specifically, and I am the contact, and we will continue to receive input and bring that information back to you. The condition assessment, I'm just going to spend a few minutes on more the most notable issues. Camping, as it turns out, tending to be the issue kind of degrading that park. It was an afterthought, so the foundation of the park is not built for the camping that was later added. Many of the violations and safety and code issues that we found had to do with camping, so by not allowing camping this year, a lot of that was eliminated. We know that the restrooms are not sized to handle the amount of camping that was occurring, as well as the the electrical system and the septic system and drain fields partially were under the camping that was occurring on the RV section. So there were a number of issues related to the camping, and so by eliminating that, we eliminate a lot of those issues. The fire pits were very small, and a fire hazard the PUD took those out of the park. We also upgraded a lot of the electrical safety issues, some of the restroom issues. We replaced the swim buoys and signage, and the port is planning to remove the concession trailer. It is not being used at this time. Some ongoing tree hazards and some unstable terrain areas, as well as some marina facilities, primarily with the dock piles that need to be replaced. Those are larger items that would be replaced later, pending long-term operation decisions. At this point, I'll turn it over to Felicity to talk about the long-term options.
The scenario we use to estimate costs for each alternative includes no camping, reduced turf area, and converting some of the park footprint into a natural area. The costs noted are to help understand the magnitude of projected ongoing expenses and capital investment needs. When the board determines the level of PUD involvement, it would be appropriate to review the planned service levels and amenities to develop accurate costs. However, keep in mind that the least cost to highest cost option for the PUD involvement does not change. For example, if we add camping back in, the operating and capital investments would change, but the least cost to highest cost would not change. In looking at our costs, options 1 and 2 appear to be very similar, and they are because they reflect the least amount of PUD involvement. The difference between option 1 and option 2 is the end goal of removing the park from our license. Option 1 represents carrying forward the existing 1979 agreement, and includes PUD cost sharing for 1 year to allow the port to develop their operating management plan and solidify options for their ongoing funding obligations. Option 2 reflects the same level of support, but but support would continue until the PUD receives approval to remove the park from the Rocky Reach license. Options 3 and 4 have increased PUD involvement. Both options show an estimate of longer-term capital investment needs to maintain and replace existing assets, as well as ongoing operating costs. In option 3, the operating estimate reflects total costs, not the cost to the PUD. The PUD's level of financial support would need to be negotiated. Option 4 represents the highest cost to the PUD, and this alternative, the PUD would take on full operations of the park. In both options 3 and 4, the capital investment to maintain or upgrade the assets on the port's property would need to be thoughtfully considered. As Michelle mentioned, the PUD typically owns the lands for parks identified in our license. It gets complicated when we don't own the property, especially when the property has been encumbered. Because of this, we did not estimate a cost share split, and the amounts represent the total regardless of who funds it. You can see that at the $1.5 to $2.5 million. Again, that would depend on the amenities selected and the amenities that are continuing to move forward based on operating requirements.
Thank you. So that is the information that we plan to provide today. We would like to give the port an opportunity to comment and add any additional input to the presentation at this time.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm Lisa Parks. I'm the executive director at the Port of Douglas County. And I wanted to start out, first of all, by again thanking you for your continued partnership with the Port of Douglas to address this issue in terms of how we best serve our community through Aranda River Park. In particular, I want to be real specific and being appreciative of both Michelle Smith and Ryan Baker. Both of them have been very helpful through this process, very professional and courteous, and their counsel has been very much appreciated. Aranda River Park, I did some history as well, so I was competing for the tallest stack of information, and I won that one. I was thinking back about this process and the year or so that we've been working on it and trying to figure out, you know, why are we all here? And so I did some of my own research into the history. And so these comments that I'm going to make about the history of the park are based on what my understanding is in our records. Essentially, what I found is that Aranda River Park has been a partnership between the port and the PUD for decades. I believe it was the second park that was built after the original license, after Eniat Park. So it's been a very long part of your project recreation facilities as part of the Rocky Reach project. 1973, even before our park was fully improved and even complete, there were discussions about expanding Aranda River Park through the Exhibit R process. 1975, Paul Currit was attending Port Commission meetings to discuss and coordinate issues at Aranda River Park around raising the pool elevation by 6 feet. And in 1976, this was news to me, 1976, the Port of Douglas actually purchased the property that the PUD now owns with the understanding that when Exhibit R was approved, the PUD would reimburse the port for that property. That purchase and reimbursement happened in early 1978. In 1978, Steve Currit attended several Port Commission meetings with the PUD's architects to review and discuss the design and amenities that were included in the expanded park area. In 1979, that's when the PUD's project to expand the park was bid and constructed. The improvements included clearing, grubbing, demolition, earthwork, site prep, irrigation, landscaping, roadway parking and paving, fencing, providing site furnishings, concrete curbing along the swim area, the picnic shelter improvements, and plantings of trees. And in August of 1980, there was a ribbon cutting that was organized by the PUD and jointly sponsored by the Port District to celebrate the new park facilities. It looked to be a fairly big deal at the time. There was a luncheon in town and then an on-site tour of the facilities and remarks from both the port and the PUD. PUD Commission President at the time, Robert Kaiser, welcomed everybody to the park, thanked the Port of Douglas for the continued support and cooperation in the preparation of the Rocky Reach Exhibit R and the design, development, and construction phases of the expanded park facility. He stated that the improvements were being built as a result of the district's approved Rocky Reach Hydroelectric Project Recreation Plan. He made note of the cooperation and support from the citizens of Douglas County, the community of Rondo, as well as local, county, state, and federal officials. He commended the citizens of the Rondo community in Douglas County for their patience and perseverance during the time of the construction, and he closed with this statement: "It is a time like this that one realizes the benefits to be gained from the many hours spent in cooperative planning. This park will provide the enjoyment for our citizens of today and many years into the future." More recently, and the cooperation and the partnership with the PUD, as Michelle mentioned, included $25,000 in 2009 as part of the relicensing of the Rocky Reach project that the PUD gave to the Port of Douglas. In 2013, the $10,000 marine facilities assessment, which actually was utilized, we saved you a little bit of money in your condition assessment. That marine facilities assessment was used as part of the more current condition assessment that was completed. And that brings us then to our most current efforts, which from early 2017 through 2018, we've been talking about this with your staff and with you. Again, very appreciative of your partnership and your help and cooperation, particularly this year as we've embarked on the unknown of a different operations plan and a partnership. It's actually been running pretty smoothly. There's good line of communication, and again, we very much appreciate the expertise that your staff brings to that process for us. In terms of the obligations, so there's a couple of complicating factors that we both face. On the port district side of things, we do have this RCO obligation. The port's working with RCO on what the implications of that obligation is, the in perpetuity requirement. We feel we're making some good progress towards understanding what that means. The good news is that it doesn't mean we have to keep throwing money at all of the facilities. RCO recognizes that built structures and facilities do become obsolete at some point in their lifespan. The not great news is that the public access to the river is the obligation that remains the in perpetuity for the foreseeable future. So the bottom line for us is we have to maintain the public access to the resource, but we are beginning to understand that there is some flexibility in terms of the built structures and facilities that are provided at the park. Our understanding of the FERC obligation, the new license issued in February of 2009 required two things with regard to Arundel River Park in Article 406. Talked about the development of a recreation resources management plan that needed to describe the seven project recreation facilities covered by the license, which included the five-acre park. And specific to Arundel River Park was that design and system upgrade to the irrigation system. There's also the general requirement to operate and maintain or arrange for the operation and maintenance of the project's recreation facilities. And the plan that was required in 2009 and completed in 2010 states that these recreation sites represent Chelan PUD's commitment to providing recreational facilities and access to the project reservoir. So in an attempt to make some lemonade from the two lemons that we each have been handed, at least the purposes of those two lemons seem to be consistent, and that is that we maintain and provide public recreational access to the Columbia River resource. So that's the good news. In terms of the long-term operating options, just first of all, two general observations. I believe the O&M costs are likely very similar regardless of who operates the park. We believe that the level of service provided to the communities we serve should be consistent, whether it's PUD park employees providing that or a contracted service that the Port of Douglas would provide. We believe that the level of service in providing those facilities should be consistent. And then, as I mentioned, I believe, given our more clear understanding of the RCO obligation, I do believe that there is greater flexibility to significantly reduce both the capital costs as well as the O&M costs as we begin to understand and move towards developing a plan and strategy that takes some of those built facilities that are more expensive to operate and maintain and move them to the obsolescence definition that the RCO provides us. So we're hoping that that provides us with some good opportunities. So with regard to the opportunities that were described by staff, from the port's perspective, our preferred alternative, and which is consistent with the original request, is that the PUD would operate the park. As we gain a better understanding of the opportunities to reduce capital and O&M costs, we believe that is a helpful piece of the equation. And our original intent, which in asking for the assistance, is not different. We are a staff of four. We do not have any maintenance personnel. Right now, all of our maintenance types of activities are contracted out to different entities, whether it's an electrical company or a building company or, in this case, a landscape company such as we have going on right now at the park. And we just believe that the PUD is in a better position and you have the expertise necessary to do the job. The secondary preference that we would have would be to subsidize the port as operator and including a new agreement that reflects the changed conditions between 1979 and 2018. A lot has changed in the past 40 years. Any agreement is necessarily going to need to be updated to reflect those changing conditions, and so that would be our secondary preference. And I believe that we would strongly be opposed to the PUD requesting FERC remove the park from the project boundary and the PUD's license. I would hope that we don't need to go that route. It is a well-utilized park. On average, in 2016-2017, the number of park visitors that were reported on your Form 80 to FERC were in the vicinity of 42,000 visitors. 2015, it was significantly less, but I think all of our park visits were down in 2015 given the status of the fires. But we believe that this park does indeed provide a lot of recreational opportunities to all of our constituents. The Arondo community uses the park for their Easter sunrise service every spring, typically. The East Wenatchee Rotary Club helps you out with your pike minnow problem in terms of salmon recovery and salmon fish recovery efforts by holding their pike minnow derby from the park every Father's Day. And we believe that there is still a number of different opportunities for partnering with the PUD to make sure that we continue to provide this important facility to our communities. So with that, I can answer any questions, and I think Jim has a few things that he'd like to say as well.
Yeah, I just basically wanted to provide some context. First of all, I want to thank you for sponsoring the annual retiree lunch, and in particular for letting me win a door prize. That's a great event, and it's really kind of heartwarming to be able to sit down with all the guys you worked with your working career, and Kibitz and BS and wade through all of that stuff. So, and thanks, Steve, for the report on the state of the PUD. Sounds like things from the bondholders' perspective are going pretty well. So that's good news. I wanted to give you, because of the fact that most of us who were involved in the original development of all the parks that the PUD has both constructed and operated, most of us from that era are aging out. So sometimes it's hard to get that perspective, but I wanted to give you a little bit of perspective on why the PUD was so aggressive in the development of parks. The requirement for recreation facilities at licensed hydro projects really evolved from a requirement that the Corps of Engineers faced back in the 1960s. They were having a really hard time because of all the environmental regulations trying to balance out their benefit-cost analysis. and they were coming up short of one-to-one benefit cost analysis, and so they decided they needed something a little bit more intangible to help balance the score. And the way that they did that was they started developing recreational facilities at all the federally developed hydroelectric projects. That evolved into at that time, Federal Power Commission essentially providing the same requirement for all of the licensed hydro projects. Chelan Hydro Project was one of the first in the country to face relicensing, and I was fortunate enough to be here at that time and spent a lot of time with FPC staff in actually helping write the regulations for the relicensing process. One of the differences between Chelan's projects and most of the others across the country is that most of the licensees are absentee owners, and a significant number of those owners are investor-owned utilities, not public utilities. So there's a different perspective from those folks than what we had at Chelan PUD, because we're resident owners. In terms of dealing with the folks who have to live around the hydro project, they're also yours and our constituents. So there's a different relationship there than what most of the licensees deal with across the country. It was a new requirement on already developed projects, the timing of it was set to happen any time that one of the licenses would be open for any particular reason, the application for an amendment or application for a new license. It would have been very inefficient for us to do all the recreation planning one project at a time as those requirements hit us. And so what we decided to do was to do a totally comprehensive recreation planning effort on all three of the hydro projects at the same time. Clearly, the economics of each of the three projects were different, but the requirement for development of those facilities was the same nonetheless. Lisa hit a key phrase in the license, which says that the PUD shall operate and maintain or arrange for operation and maintenance. That's a standard article. It's included in what's called the L-form articles in each project license. And L-form is the nomenclature that's used for projects that are on navigable waters of the U.S. and occupying federal lands. And that qualified the PUD for that particular form of license article. It became apparent early on that in order for the district to do a really good job of developing the recreation facilities, that cooperative efforts with the local communities were really important. And so in order to make its capital investment go further, the district decided that it was appropriate to the extent possible, to enter into those operating agreements with other parties. And so that in terms of how it affected the PUD budget, that the PUD could do more as far as capital development if it could obtain operators for the various recreation facilities. And we were pretty successful in doing that. And particularly where, like I say, you're not an absentee owner, you're dealing with a resident, licensee and owner of the hydro projects. And so it was an opportunity there to extend and promote and develop those kinds of solid relationships in the local area. We did some out-of-the-box things in terms of extending the benefit in the local communities. We replaced the Rock Island Golf Course. There was no obligation to do that, but had we not done that, when the pool was raised at Rock Island, the golf course, the old golf course, would have been totally inundated. So the PUD, in the name of vector control, taking care of mosquitoes, reconfigured the shoreline around the ponds at Rock Island to enable it to accommodate a new golf course. We replaced the ice rink that was downtown Wenatchee. There was no obligation to do that, but in order to further the relationships again, the PUD relocated the ice rink from where it was down near the river to the location where it was at the end of Fifth Street. and since then it has moved to the town Toyota Center. But it wouldn't have happened. There was no obligation to do that. But it was the right thing to do. And you could find examples of that all the way along all of the reservoirs, all three of the hydro projects. And the PUD really developed a very solid relationship and reputation among the regulatory agencies for taking that extra step, going the extra mile in working with our communities and developing those facilities. Part of the philosophy was also that to the extent that the PUD was exporting essentially almost all of the power benefits, there was an opportunity there to maximize the local benefit, where the costs of not only the development, but subsequently the operation and maintenance of the facilities would be exported along with power sales. And so there was an opportunity to take the pressure off of the local taxpayers as far as the operation and maintenance of those facilities, and put that in as part of the hydro project power costs. And in relative terms, it's a pretty small amount of the total PUD budget for the hydro facilities. We were generous enough in the development of facilities that we actually ended up in arbitration with Puget Sound Power and Light at that time on the Rock Island project, and we went to arbitration. So I would suggest that any new agreements that the PUD enter into not include an arbitration clause with a private party. It creates an uneven playing field because of the public disclosure requirements. So just a hint. So it was pretty well known that the PUD ultimately would be operating and maintaining most of those facilities and, again, exporting those costs. Now, I don't know if you know why Douglas PUD is the only public utility purchaser of Chelan PUD power. Anybody know? Dennis says yes. It was actually a product of a settlement for encroachment on the Wells Hydro project site. Be that as it may, as a hydro project purchaser, Douglas PUD actually, PUD ratepayers actually pay more of the cost of the Rocky Reach recreational facilities than the Chelan PUD ratepayers, primarily because of the surplus power sales and subsidization of the electric rate for the PUD's retail customers. So the question arose at one time in a conversation with one of your commissioners that why doesn't Douglas PUD step up and help with the operation and maintenance of that facility at Arundel Park? Well, quite simply, it's not part of any of the Wells project licensing requirements, which is Douglas PUD's obligation. But again, because of the arrangement that we have, like I said, the customers at Douglas PUD actually pay more for Rocky Reach recreational facilities than do your ratepayers. And that includes all the facilities, not just Arundel Park. So, you know, we are, in fact, making a contribution. Now, unfortunately, because of our role as a port district.
Jim, I'm going to interrupt. We have six more items.
I'll keep it shorter.
Thank you.
I'm pretty close to the end here.
Good.
We're in the process of, as co-owner of the regional airport, Pangbourne Airport, of having to facing increasing subsidies for the continued operation of that facility. And we're doing that, but it's putting pressure on our budget. We're constrained in how we can raise tax revenues because of Tim Iman years ago. We have very significant constraints on how we can increase our budgets. We faced 9/11 at the airport, which increased a significant number of costs relative to security, as have you, and TSA requirements at the terminal facility. Our ability to raise revenues through passenger facility charges is limited by the FAA. And so it's kind of a convergence of issues that we've been trying to reduce costs where we can. Arundel Park being, and We all know that parks don't make money. If you know how to solve that, we would like to know. So that's why we've turned to the PUD and asked for some additional help. Like I said, our ability to fund that is pretty limited because of our political structure. So that's why we're here and talking about maybe engaging in a longer-term, more cooperative relationship. And again, well, whatever money we save at Arondo Park essentially enables us to help provide that subsidy for the operation and maintenance of the airport. So that's probably a whole lot more than you really wanted to hear, but I thought, it was, given the opportunity, it was good to share with you that context before all of us that were part of that process in the first place age out.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Because of time, we have six more items before we complete our morning session, and I want to give time to those commissioners. Any thoughts, comments, questions related to the Arondo Park? And also, Lisa, thanks to you and to the board for providing us information. We do appreciate it and hope that it continues in the cooperative vein. I believe that it will.
Absolutely. Quick question for Lisa.
Huh?
Again, what was the, I don't remember exactly how the purchase and then the purchase of the PUD's 1.3 acres, how that worked, and somebody was reimbursed. Could you go quickly? Mention that again.
Yes. So in the minutes of Port of Douglas Commission meetings, there was one statement where Mr. Currid explained that the PUD was unable to expand at the time the Arondo property was for sale, so the Port of Douglas County purchased the land with the understanding that when Exhibit R was approved, the Chelan County PUD would reimburse the port for that property. And then in 1978, again, that Mr. Pope explained that the port had helped the Chelan PUD acquire land for the Rocky Reach Dam project and that Exhibit R was part of that agreement. So there was the reimbursement actually happened in 1978.
And that was the 1.3 acres.
That was the property. There's two separate parcels that are right to the north, but yes.
Yeah. I do want to point out that there was a total of 25 acres that were purchased, that the PUD purchased. A lot of that's underwater, so when we raised the reservoir with the building of Rocky Reach Dam, we had to purchase some of the property to the north that, if you look on a map now, is underwater. And only about 1.4 acres was above water that could be added to the park. Mm-hmm. It's my understanding there was an orchard and a residential home on the property that's immediately adjacent, that with the road and the county road and everything going, there's no access to our 1.4 acres without an easement through the port's property. So access to the 1.4 acres wasn't also a problem. And I think all of those things combined led to the purchase and the later development and the PUD purchasing that property.
Yep.
In total, it was about the same amount of acreage on both sides of the river that were acquired for initial construction of Rocky Reach.
Okay, and then just one last thing for Lisa. As soon as you get more clarity on exactly what your RCO obligation is, that would be really helpful, I think, for us to know that.
Yeah, so it is a moving target, but essentially my conference call with the RCO staff is if we can make a legitimate argument about the built structures, essentially, the marina facilities, the restroom facilities, anything that's a built structure, if we can make a request to them that those things have reached their useful life and they can be basically abandoned, removed, taken out. Bottom line, we took boating facilities money for that park. The intent is that it would remain available, but that doesn't mean that you couldn't provide informal access, boating access to the water is essentially what Myra Barker with RCO is indicating to us.
That's a really good piece of information.
Yeah, that is.
To relieve your concerns, also, our ports are no longer trying to pursue upriver navigation. I worked with George Seller, Senator Seller, when I was on staff at the PUD. On an almost monthly basis, he would come in with a new scheme of how to develop upriver navigation. And then we would talk about the environmental implications.
There we go. Any other thoughts, questions, comments? Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you so much.
We'll continue.
Yep.
Integrated Resource Plan.
Janet Chesters.
Thank you, Jim. Keating will be presenting today.
Paul Currit, Steve Currit, Steve Potter.
I know. Okay. Yeah.
Morning, Commissioners. Becky Keating, Janet Jespers, Energy Resources, here to continue our 2018 Integrated Resource Plan Progress Report public process. We were here on May 14th to visit you with our initial portfolio analysis results, and we have not had any change in our load resource analysis since that time. We're not asking any to take any action today, but we would like to give you a little more information as well as provide you with the document itself. We're going to give you some updates to the 2016 short-term plan and summarize the progress report's recommendations. We will be back on June 25th in a legal hearing to ask for your approval of the progress report by resolution. So today, again, over the summary of recommendations and conservation updates to the short-term plan, and Janet will talk about other energy resources updates to the short-term plan, then we'll go over the remaining schedule. Summary of recommendations remains as it has in previous IRPs and progress reports. The district to retain its current mix of generating resources to meet load and the Washington State Renewable Portfolio Standard requirements through this planning period, which goes through 2028. Continuing to evaluate and implement conservation programs, in this case based on the most recent CPA, which was done in 2017. And to keep evaluating and implementing additional strategies for power sales consistent with the district's financial policies and hedging strategy. Our 2016 short-term plan conservation goals included implementing cost-effective programs that comply with the RPS. In 2000 update in 2016 and 17, district achieved 4.12 average megawatts of savings. The target was 1.78, so significantly more. In 2016, goal to achieve over 2 average megawatts in 2016 alone, and that goal was achieved with 2.04 average megawatts. Plan was to conduct energy efficiency audits, residential and commercial, to help improve the results of the next conservation potential assessment with more accurate detail of our area. And that was also accomplished. Approximately 450 homes and 1,200 commercial buildings were audited in 2016, and the results of the most recent CPA were greatly improved because of that. plans to conduct strategic energy management surveys at some commercial customers. That is ongoing right now. There's a consultant working with approximately 10 large commercial customers to help establish continuous energy efficiency programs. Excuse me. Plan to assess all, take an inventory of and assess all street lighting, publicly owned street lighting in the county in 2016. That inventory has been done, and the district is working on replacing approximately 3,700 streetlights with LED lighting this year, and has obtained grant funding for more than a third of the cost of the project. District continues to participate with the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance collaboration in improving new consumer products and efficiency of new consumer products. District planned to utilize an improved conservation model that better accounted for energy shaping and wholesale prices. And that also that is being done. The new model is being used to help evaluate potential and also potential demand response programs. In 2016, there was a plan to evaluate more residential programs surrounding home construction. There's been a very successful smart thermostat program put in place for consumers and also as well as contractor-driven program. The construction pilot program didn't receive any applications, and so the district is still looking for builders interested in building beyond code. And now Janet is going to talk about other energy resource bullet points from the short-term plan and updates.
Thank you, Becky. One of the first updates was just to continue to track state and federal climate change and environmental legislation. And so there was a lot of action concerning carbon tax in the most recent couple of years, and that is covered in the draft. Also, kind of the oversupply issues can push prices around in the Northwest, which is covered. and then one thing that the board has been updated on just recently is kind of the climate change and how it could affect the snowpack and when the runoff actually occurs. And specifically, more effort in 2018 is going to be focused on the Lakeland operations. Another one, the electric vehicle growth in Chelan County was just slightly above what was forecasted in the 2016 base case. Continuing to look at that. And then there's been another recent update on the high density load and high density load growth, which I'm sure you're very familiar with. So looking at rates, policies, and development of that. Back in mid-May, we came with the initial portfolio analysis, and today we're here with the final draft. And then in 2 weeks, we're going to be back with the final draft. and present the resolution that will need to be approved by the board at that point. So here's our PDIRP website. You can get some of the information here. We do have the spot at the bottom where we will continue to receive comments. And just want to remind the board that this kind of the whole recommendation in the IRP is just at a snapshot in time, and the board can change their recommendations at any point in the future.
Okay. Commissioners, thoughts, comments, questions?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Yep.
Thank you.
The prep on this has been outstanding, so thank you. Resiliency.
Yeah, we want to invite Suzanne Grisel to come up. We recently filed comments in a FERC proceeding that have received some applause. Suzanne worked on that. I want to give you a chance to hear a little bit about it.
That was a glamorous start. I'm Suzanne Grisel. I'm the Governmental Affairs Program Manager. I focus on monitoring federal issues for the district. And today I'm going to talk about how we're highlighting hydropower's role in contributing to grid resiliency. So I know this is an exciting title. Because of this, I'm promising to keep it to under 45 minutes.
And yes, you will.
I'm definitely going to try to keep it under 10 minutes. But I do want to point out that this is really a very hot topic in the electric sector. There is an ongoing proceeding at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I'm going to provide a little bit of context. You can go ahead and read this while I mention that last September, the Department of Energy issued a proposed order that would have required cost recovery for plants with on-site fuel supply of 90 days. This is basically a nuclear and coal. And you may have heard also that First Energy, based in Ohio, has been asking for some kind of support for nuclear and coal facilities that face the potential of retirement. The administration has been asked to use their emergency powers in this manner. Well, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission rejected the proposed rule, but asked regional grid operators to weigh in on the concept of resiliency in the electric sector. So just for context, they proposed that definition be the ability to withstand and reduce the magnitude and or duration of disruptive events, which includes the capability to anticipate, absorb, adapt to, and or rapidly recover from such an event.
Suzanne, if I could just add quickly before I lose it, on-site fuel of 90 days, how do you do that in a hydro scenario?
You know, that was just one of the issues that came up in terms of the response that NHA provided at the time, which was, you know, we're very resilient as hydropower, and I'm going to get to that a little bit later. But was that really captured in their 90-day fuel supply definition? And that was the question, and not necessarily. So a lot of industry associations commented, a lot of fuel sources commented on looking at the attributes that provide resiliency and not necessarily the fuel types. Okay. So we'll cover that a little bit later. So the regional transmission organizations and independent service operators all responded, and then FERC invited input from industry. So why did we submit comments, even though we are not in an organized market? So our goal is really to ensure that hydropower continues to operate economically in a changing electric system. And we weren't necessarily planning to provide comments, and then shortly before they were due, and National Hydropower Association had its conference. Chairman McIntyre presented and mentioned this is a specifically important proceeding. And also the National Hydropower Association really urged members to comment on behalf of hydropower. So all of these things are happening. We have, for us, the California market influences pricing of services traded in the Western power market, which affects the value of our surplus hydro. We all know that the electric grid is changing with the influx of renewable generation. Energy prices are generally decreasing while the value of reliability and resiliency is increasing. And all of this is happening while we see this major need for reinvestment in the hydropower system. Just wanted to mention that I think about 400 to 500 hydro projects are up for relicensing by 2030, obviously including the Rock Island project. That's kind of the context. Wind and solar have been the kind of face of public policy debate over the past few years, and now we're really looking at a lot of attention to coal and nuclear, and hydropower is so often left out of the debate, even though, as this slide shows, hydropower has all of the attributes necessary for a reliable and resilient grid. You can look at this, and then we'll go through it piece by piece, but hydropower is the only one that shows green across the whole chart. And we have made use of this chart in a couple of different forums now. So here are the issues that we generally raised in our comments. The need for flexible capacity, that the California independent service operator would need to procure these services at higher costs without Northwest hydropower. Yet the existing market design doesn't fully compensate hydropower for its flexibility, and that is more and more important with the influx of solar generation and the ramping needs. We also pointed out that hydro is really often a victim of price discrimination in two ways, between in-state and out-of-state power and between new and existing resources. And we're concerned that this lack of price signals for hydropower could result in underinvestment in the resource, even though it's providing all of these services that are important. And so you put that in terms of grid resilience when responding to the comments. And these are some of the comments that we, or the recommendations that we made. I want to thank Greg Carrington's Energy Resources Group for helping review and edit the comments. Tuli Hakala and Brian Bradshaw were especially helpful. So these are the comments. I won't read through them, but essentially we describe how Northwest Hydro is ideally suited to provide services that California needs. and that regional markets need to incentivize the services in a way that optimizes them and provides the needed reinvestment signals. And then I also wanted to mention that relatively recently, the Department of Energy's Water Power Program asked for industry to provide input on how hydropower contributes to grid reliability and resiliency. And we did respond to that as well, making some recommendations about how the department should study some of these issues and how hydropower participates. So we will continue to monitor those efforts as well. And then I just wanted to emphasize this last point on the chart. Our view is that if a resource can provide the needed service, it should be eligible to receive value in the marketplace. And the focus should be on the service that's provided and not necessarily the energy resource that provides it. And there's also, of course, a regional component. Each region's different. Reliability and resiliency needs may be different. But in our view, hydropower performs well under any objective measure of resilience. And then next steps, you know, FERC is considering reply comments and may decide whether additional action on resilience is warranted. We just got some news on Friday, though, that we're not quite sure how it's going to fit into the whole evaluation. President Trump has directed the Secretary of Energy, Rick Perry, to prepare immediate steps to stop the loss of fuel-secure power facilities, coal and nuclear. So we've seen kind of a draft memo. We haven't seen an order yet. We don't know how that's going to apply to the industry. We're thinking it may be a two-year proposal. So we'll have to kind of wait and see how this affects the ongoing FERC proceeding, but it's definitely a high-level issue. And from Chalet and PUD's perspective, we will just continue to promote hydropower. It's fair value for reliability and resilience. It's optimal dispatch for its highest and best use, and the necessary investment in price signals to promote reinvestment in now an aging system. Are there any questions?
I just want to add that this latest news is really disappointing and frustrating, because now what we have are the non-dispatchable renewable resources getting subsidies, and the coal and nuclear plants essentially saying, well, they're getting so many subsidies, we're not economic, so now we're going to give subsidies to coal and nuclear. And so the primary resources on this system from a national perspective that are not receiving subsidies are now natural gas and hydropower, the ones that provide the flexible capacity that creates the reliability on the system. I can only say the system is broken. When you have to add more subsidies to offset other subsidies, something mm-hmm. is really broken here. And this fits the comments that we have made over the course of the last year, that we think that characteristics of resources should provide value in the marketplace and should be compensated as such. So in other words, if you bring the right characteristics, then compensate those. Don't compensate the generating resource just because of what it is. That doesn't make sense. So. Thanks to Suzanne for making our points very articulately in this process, and we still have an uphill climb to go here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thoughts, comments?
Thank you, Suzanne.
Suzanne, thank you very much. Appreciate it, and thanks for helping us out on some time.
I'm going to invite Felicity back up to talk about public power benefit. We really need to... hopefully by our next meeting, come to a conclusion about the funding levels for 2018 and 2019. So this will be preparation for that.
Felicity Saberhagen, business advisor, here to give you get some information about public power benefits and get some guidance from you for the resolution next week. We'll be recapping what we covered at the last meeting on May 14th. I'll provide a little more information on the job and work readiness opportunity. We'll have a little discussion about public power benefits for 2018 and 19 funding levels, and we'll review questions and next steps. To recap where we were last week, 3 weeks ago, excuse me. Public power benefit funding for 2018, there's still 900,000 remaining to be assigned. Staff has recommended that we assign the remaining 900,000 to the Rocky Reach Museum story. The current estimate for that project is just shy of $1 million. For 2019, staff has recommended that we fund between $3 and $4 million for the public power benefit funding level for that year, as well as $2.45 million in projects, including $2.3 million for fiber, $50,000 for the park's day use pass, and $100,000 for the remaining amount to cover the museum story. Our jobs work readiness program, I mentioned it last week that we were working on a partnership. We're working with the Chelan Douglas Developmental Disabilities Agency to find an opportunity for a developmentally disabled position through our job and work readiness program. This is already funded, does not require any additional funding, and does meet our criteria to provide opportunities that reflect the diversity of our community. The position would be part-time. It's an 18-month pilot program that would cost approximately $30,000 to $35,000. Again, this is covered by a prior allocation and does not require any additional funding to be approved today.
But going back to the conversation we had at the last meeting, so we've been very cautious about ideas that come from individual board members, making sure that the full board is made aware of those and that we don't act just as a result of a request from an individual board member. This did originally come up from Commissioner Congdon quite some time ago, so we have explored it. It does make sense to us to proceed, but we wanted to make sure there was visibility for the full board and candidly would like the head nod from the board that there's comfort with moving forward with this action.
How about an amen?
Great, you know,
the interesting part, when I heard that, I looked over at the wall, and it fits. I mean, if you look at the big picture, what's good for our
utility. So just, Steve, you care to weigh in?
No, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, I had to step out for a second.
No, just in terms of what Steve Wright just mentioned, in terms of a head nod.
No, I'm okay. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Just clarification, the $32,000 goes to a position that will lead this development.
No, it's actually this will be a paid position for,
right.
And so this is just to fund that component of it. We would fund the management of our staff is through our normal operations.
Right.
The position we're looking at is through our office services group.
Right. You said the same thing, but more articulately for me. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. You're welcome. For the resolution for next meeting, we have talked about the $900,000 that would be needed to fund the Rocky Reach Discovery Center in 2018. Wanted to take a moment and just figure out if that's something you would like to see on the resolution for next meeting. Again, a reminder, this is the presentation that Casey Hall gave you at the last meeting.
With Casey and Debbie in the room, how can we decline?
It does make it difficult, I'll give you that.
Again, head nod. Okay.
Great, thank you. And funding for 2019, we had a recommendation between $3 and $4 million. The $3 million represents about what we have spent on the program, what has been allocated of the available funding over the life of the program. The $4 million is what we have been allocating over the years, and that range is something that can be supported through our past financial performance as well as what we're looking at for our future projected performance.
And I'd just like to add that from the time that we made the original presentation and left the door open as to whether the $3 to $4 million. I think the financial performance this year would justify staying at the $4 million level. And we also do have the opportunity to revisit this entire issue as part of strategic planning next year.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, I'd be very supportive. The thing that emerges in my mind, we've got a couple of things that have emerged that we don't know today what they might look like a year from now, and providing that flexibility, just because we authorize it doesn't mean we're going to end up spending it.
That's a great point. Thank you.
May recall that from a prior presentation, we have not spent the full allocation in most years for public power benefit.
Right.
With that, I'm going to assume we would like to put the $4 million on the resolution. Is that correct?
Please.
Yes.
And there were $2.45 million in project funding that staff had suggested includes fiber for $2.3 million, the Rocky Reach Discovery Center, the remaining $100,000 to help fund that piece, and $50,000 for Parks Day use. Is there for those three projects as well? Next week, I will bring back a resolution with the funding decisions that we've made today. So you will see that, and that can be approved in the June 25th meeting. In fall, we'll be back again with a program update. At that point, you would have an opportunity to consider allocating any remaining additional funds. In this case, it would be a little over $1.5 million that's still remaining in the program. Also, the other portion of the presentation that you saw on the Rocky Reach Museum Center included $2.4 million to fund tenant improvements in the Discovery Center that will be later called the Discovery Center. If that piece of it does not require approval today, but I just wanted you to be aware that would be funded through the budget, the normal budgeting and planning process that we go through. Were there any questions?
Comment for Steve on one project that I know is, you know, we're making progress on, but I don't know when the updates come. I'm just curious how the Hydro Institute is doing and where that's going at the appropriate moment.
Yeah, I think it's in good shape, and you did allocate additional monies in 2018. Should carry us through at least this year. And Kirk, do you want to add anything with respect to future plans for that?
Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission, and things are going well. We're, in fact, working on bylaws and articles of incorporation right now to get the Hydropower Research Institute started. We would expect that we have funding to carry us through the remainder of this year and to begin aggregating data with Chelan, PUD, Army Corps of Engineers, and Southern Company this year. That being said, we're going to learn a lot in the next 6 months, and there will be significant opportunities going forward, for sure.
What an incredible project.
Yes.
It really is.
Yeah.
This is all good.
Thank you.
Great time to be a commissioner.
Were there any other questions?
At least I think we're good.
Great. Thank you so much.
Appreciate your time.
The chairs program, I was looking around nervously, and poof, they appear.
I don't know when we can do.
Yeah, I know.
Just in time is on time.
A couple weeks ago, there was a pilot being
done. So when I invite Ron Gibbs up.
Confluence Park. A lot of kids were playing in the grass, jumping in the water.
What's that? Yeah.
We'll see if we can arrange that every single
time. Fun. How long?
A little tough.
And you weren't.
So you recall that every year we give you an update on the insurance program, and we're at that point again. So, Ron, take it away.
All right. Ron Gibbs, Insurance and Claims Manager. This, as Steve alluded to, is our annual update on insurance premiums and the renewal. And the presentation is for informational purposes only. No action is required today. And the renewal date is July 1st, 2018, of course. Premiums and terms will be negotiated right up to the renewal date. And we will be requesting a motion authorizing the insurance program renewal with a not to exceed amount. And that will come to the board on June 25th, requesting that motion. We have three main takeaways from the presentation today. First, the worldwide insurance market is changing due to the extreme year of natural disasters. So on the property insurance side. The district is favorably viewed by insurance carriers due in large part to our forward-thinking asset management strategies, and premium quotes are consistent with the 2018 insurance budget. Our insurance program marketing effort supports the district value of stewardship, protecting public resources entrusted to us by managing risks and controlling costs. So each year we meet with as many insurance carriers as possible in order to maximize competition for our business. And insurance companies compete by offering low premiums and sometimes better policy terms. Excuse me. This year, the recommendation is to keep limits and deductibles the same. and the messages that we deliver during our marketing meetings with underwriters generally highlights the quality and successes of the PUD operations and our overall risk management. The insurance underwriters love to hear about the work that we are doing to develop our asset management program, and in particular, they are interested in our efforts in predictive maintenance, and that's where we attempt to project the degradation of the generators over time. And of course, it's in the insurance carrier's best interest to, if we can intervene with repairs or replacement before those generators experience major failures. So the asset management program also helps us identify the most critical equipment and systems for reliability so that we can prioritize our maintenance. During our meetings, the underwriters were very positive about plans for the Hydro Research Institute, and they appreciate the fact that we are innovative in trying to develop new techniques to improve generation reliability. I also share with the underwriters the collaboration that occurs between our generation management and insurance fire engineers. The district staff will often run questions about plant fire protection via the insurance engineer to take advantage of his expertise. During our meetings, I also respond to any concerns the underwriters might have, including the recent B9 claim that we have at Rock Island. And I try to help them understand the root causes of any failures that occur, as well as mitigation efforts that we have trying to prevent other issues from arising. Some of the factors influencing the renewal this year include the district's financial strength, our AA rating, and information I provide about our upcoming construction projects at the dams demonstrates our commitment to investing in our resources before they start having age-related failures. Carriers prefer that approach as opposed to being forced to replace equipment as it fails. Another factor affecting the renewal this year is the changing property insurance market. As I mentioned, the world insurance reserves have been reduced significantly due to the high natural disaster costs that occurred in 2017. Hurricane Harvey totaled $135 billion in damages, and that was the second highest cost hurricane in history, including even factoring in inflation. And then Hurricanes Maria and Irma caused another $140 billion in damages. So the insurance carriers, part of that was $135 billion that they paid in 2017. And there were some other losses included there too, but that was the highest on record for insurance companies. And the utility sector had $14 billion in losses from the California wildfires, so that we get joined into paying for some of those costs as well. But fortunately, there have not been many hurricanes over the last 10 years, so insurance reserves were very well funded prior to 2017, but if we have another hurricane season like last year, then the insurance companies will be increasing the rates pretty significantly. So overall, our approach with insurance marketing is to establish long-term relationships with insurance companies so that they get to know us and recognize us as a quality risk, and this provides stability when the market shifts or if we have claims. And we try to keep those carriers honest by pursuing quotes from the entire marketplace, and that encourages competition and helps us during negotiations. Occasionally, we do have to switch out carriers. So just going through the major insurance policies, you can see our property insurance premiums last year were $1,149,000. This year, we are projecting $1,244,000. So that's an 8.3% increase. Again, I think reflective of the impact of the hurricanes on the market. On the liability side, last year we paid $858,000. We expect to pay $895,000. And as I've been mentioning, we are continuing with the negotiations. I'm hoping that we can actually get this number down a little bit, but right now we're at a 4.3% increase.
Which, by the way, is a little bit lower than the number I gave you last week, and I just misread the chart, so it's a little better than what I had told you. Thank you.
This gives you an idea about where we've been over the last 12 or so years, 13 years, I guess. And you can see we had a pretty significant jump in 2014 and 15, after the servo rod claims that we had at Rocky Reach. And then we've also added about $50 million in liability limits in the last few years, as well as cyber liability insurance. So it's not an exact apples to apples, but at least it gives you an idea. And we were getting some decreases over the last few years until the hurricane season. So this is a listing of all of the policies that we'll be renewing. The cyber liability insurance policy, that covers insurance where customers or employees' personal data is stolen during cyber attacks. I was asked to provide a little bit of information on this topic. So in addition to covering the claims, any claims made against the district, the policy would pay for credit monitoring services, forensic work to identify the source of the breach, and then customer outreach. So the carrier also provides our IT staff with regular updates on best practices and things we can do to help defend against those attacks. And we've had the policy in place since 2015, and the price has come down about 20% over those last few years. But overall, we're looking at an increase of 6.8% for this year, and that's consistent with the 2018 budget. Still negotiating. So for the June 25th, our recommendation will be to complete the annual negotiation process with a not-to-exceed amount. Currently, we're at $2,275,000 for the premium renewals. And you can see the draft motion here that we will be approaching the board with. And again, as negotiations continue, this number could change before June 25th. So the next steps, again, to continue negotiations and try and get the best terms and conditions that we can get, return on June 25th for the new motion, and then complete the insurance policy renewals by July 1st. Are there any questions?
Mr. Smith?
just wanted to circle back on a comment you made early in the presentation to make sure I heard you right. You said the insurance folks were very interested in what we're doing in terms of the development of our Hydro Institute.
Absolutely. That was part of my presentation to them. And they were very interested, asked lots of questions. And so, yeah, I told them we're still in the preliminary stages, but they saw a lot of promise in that whole project.
Interesting. Thank you.
You bet. Yeah, I think that's dollar signs across the industry.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
I think it's good for us, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
A question with respect to our increase recently in S&P rating. Has that had any kind of a positive impact on our insurance cost?
Yeah, anytime that they can see our financial strength, and then I always bring that up in the insurance marketing presentation that I give to underwriters, and I explain that because we have the financial strength, we can invest in our resources to properly maintain them and replace it. So that definitely ties into reliability and, of course, insurance best interest as well.
Great. Thank you.
Yep.
Another plus.
Anything else?
Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Always look forward to your presentation. I mean, yes. You know, some people wouldn't think insurance is all that exotic and exciting, but it's an integral part of what we do, and you do it well. So thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Substation efforts.
I just want to check real quick. I'm not sure if we have enough time to really get going on this. What do you think, John? But do you have a time constraint? You'd rather do it now? Or?
Do you want to?
Are you able to come back after lunch? Okay,
so I think. Thinking, do we have like a manager item that we could move in there and then bring that into the manager item time slot?
Yes.
Okay.
That would work. I'd like to do that.
All right. Yeah, because we need to do justice on this one. We really
yes.
do. Scar tissue.
So I'd like to invite Kelly up to do a manager's
item. Nice.
Good morning, Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer, and thank you for the nice segue actually into this manager's item update. As you do know and have mentioned, we've been working on rating agency updates over the last few months for two reasons. One, it was the right timing for S&P and Moody's to do their periodic updates. Their internal process requirements are about every 2 years. They do a deeper dive into the rating updates. And then the second reason was related to our process for the substitution of the standby bond purchase agreement.
for our variable rate bonds because we're switching providers. So since the last board meeting, we have updates on all of these. And the first one and the very exciting one was what Commissioner Arsenault already mentioned, that S&P upgraded our consolidated debt rating to AA plus stable, which now matches our Fitch rating. And we issued a press release, celebrated a little bit, and we were really happy with this outcome because we've been working really hard to achieve this level that puts us among the top five highly rated public utilities by S&P. So in S&P's grouping, we were among the top five of our peers. And the key strengths that they cited in their report were our rapidly declining debt leverage, maintenance of extremely strong debt coverage ratio, our strong unrestricted cash liquidity, very strong risk management and financial policies, experienced management, and the extremely low-cost power supply. And then they did give extra note that all of these metrics were achieved without a retail electric rate increase for almost 6 years. And then, as they always do, they also cited our challenges as they see them, which included our economic base lacks breadth and depth, so just the community we live in, and our exposure to variable water years, which can affect our net wholesale revenue. But they also acknowledge that our hedging program has reduced this risk in recent years. So it's nice to have that challenge followed up by positive recognition. S&P also provides rating on our additional Rocky Reach and Rock Island lien bonds and a subordinate lien bond for Rock Island. And each of those were affirmed at their current AA, and the subordinate is AA-. And they all have stable outlooks. So that was a really great outcome for S&P. And then we did recently receive Moody's update, and they affirmed our AA3 stable debt rating. It was a lot more fun to report that upgrade to AA+, but the AA3 rating, which is equivalent to a AA- in the rating conventions, is still very high credit quality. We advocated for rating improvement, but Moody's chose to affirm our current rating, and they cited their key strengths and challenges as a strong liquidity position, robust risk management, including our ongoing hedging program, and our almost 50% in debt reduction over the last 8 years. That was a major positive development that has served to balance against our credit negative events, which they note as credit deterioration of a major long-term customer, weakening wholesale market conditions, and the mixed operational performance of the hydros. They also note that the low wholesale market conditions and our exposure to water volatility remain the most significant long-term risks, especially as we rely on that surplus wholesale revenue to subsidize our retail business. So our next review with Moody's is likely to be in about 2020, but we've dedicated ourselves to continue to take every opportunity to demonstrate our credit strength and advocate for a higher rating that we would believe better reflects our very strong credit profile, and we'll take every opportunity to do that until then. As to the standby bond purchase agreement, all the required rating updates were received, and we are on track to finalize the substitution agreement on June 22nd. So that's also great news. So as part of all this, I wanted to thank you as a board for your continued dedication to setting strong financial policies and making decisions that are consistent with those policies. It really takes the entire organization, everyone doing their unique part to achieve and maintain such strong results, and we all did it together. I'd also like to recognize the leadership of Debbie Litchfield and Heather Ireland, which was also key to our success. And when I sum all of this up, I think the most important part of these ratings updates are that they are an independent review of our financial health, a wellness check, and they give our customer owners confidence that we are in strong financial shape. So along with this, I also just handed out the updated summary of all of our ratings. That's a kind of that nice at-a-glance look at all of the agencies and our key strengths and challenges. And then on the back is the comparison of our peer ratings, just as a handy reference guide. So with that, are there any questions?
Just a comment. You know, there's over 2,000 public power agencies in the United States. And when you get into the top five, that's pretty darn good. You know, I mean, that's a significant accomplishment.
That's why it takes that entire organization, because it is such a great accomplishment.
And I'd like to just chime in and point out that to achieve these kinds of successful results in today's marketplace is even harder than it was 10 years ago. After the great recession that we had, all of the rating agencies were slapped pretty hard for maybe not rating or giving enough thought to the ratings that they issued. So they are doubly focused on making sure that every agency truly deserves and has gone above and beyond in order to receive an upgrade on their ratings. It is really hard to get an upgrade. And the fact that we got one, that's amazing. Great testimony to you guys and all your effort and staff's effort, management. Just good job, everybody.
Thank you.
I'll just add, in addition to what Kelly said in terms of thanks to the board and to Debbie and Heather, Kelly's really strong leadership is key to this too. So I want to thank her for her work.
Thank you.
Comments, questions? I think we're at a point for lunch recess. We will take a recess now at 12 and reconvene at 1. Good afternoon, and welcome to the afternoon session, the business session of Chelan County PUD. It is 1:03, and we're beginning our afternoon session with the consent agenda. This morning, we added or did not take anything off of the consent agenda. So looking at it, commissioners, what are your wishes?
I move approval of the consent agenda.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved. 2 seconds.
3 seconds.
3 seconds. We're on it. It's been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda as presented. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Resolution 14.
The resolution rejecting the bid of Turbine Pros, LLC of Chattanooga, Tennessee, and accepting the bid of Brevo Corporation of Cheney, Washington, bid 18-30 for Rock Island Powerhouse 2, Units 1, 4, and 6, draft tube gate refurbishments. Devin's going to help us here.
Yep. I'm Devin Myers, the project manager down at Rock Island. And that's exactly right. This is a resolution to reject the low bid and award to the next low bid. Reasons for rejecting is Turbine Pros was the low bid, but they did not submit a bid bond as specified in the contract documents. And they also took some other exceptions to our commercial terms. Brevo Corporation was the second low bid, and they did meet all specifications of the contract documents.
And do I understand that you're working with the low bidder to help them better understand
yes.
the process?
Yes. Yeah. We were talking with Bruce about that, and they're going to, when this, as the dust settles around this issue right here, then they will contact Turbine Pros and talk to them about, because they are new to trying to get work with us, and they've been showing up at several of our pre-bids, and so I think they'd like to work here. Better knowledge of how to do that would be good.
Sure. Just having to know how to navigate, right? Get
yep.
around everything.
Yep. Yeah.
So, good.
Okay. Any questions?
None. Thank
okay.
you very much.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Thanks. Just a comment, Devin. When I looked over there, I thought I recognized you, and I didn't connect it. Good. It's been a long time.
Been a while.
Yeah. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Yeah.
Was he one of your students?
No,
that's just...
His dad and I served on the school board together.
Oh, very good. Very good. I was just making fun of myself in that proverbial question. item 15, manager items, and we're going to start with the substation.
We would like to come back to the 2008 substation effort update. So we're going to have John Stoll and Chad Wispin talk through a variety of things, but a big part of this is where are we going generally with the substation. So
very short reprieve, gentlemen, for lunch.
Rebecca's not up, is it?
No. Did we vote to approve 14?
Pardon me?
Did we vote to approve 14?
I don't think we did.
You did not vote on
no, we didn't.
14.
Why? What's your point?
I move approval of Resolution 14.
Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Been moved and seconded to approve Resolution 14 as presented. Is there discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. And thank you for letting me down gracefully.
It was Randy.
Randy. Appreciate it.
I was going to bring it back at the end.
I've told Rebecca all day I need help. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Gentlemen.
It's just been so long since we've talked substations. You wanted to get right.
I have been anticipating.
Well,
I could barely sleep last night.
All right. Well, good afternoon, commissioners. John Stoll, managing director, and with me is Chad Wispin, director of engineering and asset management. And as previewed, we're here to kind of give you an update on where we stand with a pretty active year-round substations. So this is strictly informational, although we will be talking through some issues that certainly like to hear your perspective and feedback as we move forward. We're really going to break this into two parts. We have three what I would call active substations. You'll hear more about that from where they are and the next step in land rights, planning, permitting, and those issues. And then we want to take a little bit deeper look into what we see down the road, 10 to 15 years. And I think what we heard from the last effort was the earlier we can get ahead of siting substations and having the land ready, the better. And there's a number of reasons that we'll talk through as well that support that concept and approach. So we'd like to commit that this has been a really key priority, not only for myself, but Chad and his staff and even Andrew Wendell and his team who've been out. You know, a lot of work's been going on and communicating with a lot of our stakeholders, primarily the county and the various municipalities. Just working with their planning departments and really, you know, just communicating what the future looks like and how we can work together. And really, we've had some great support. So that's been a key focus in addition to what's been going on more specifically around design of the substations. One thing I'll touch on later, but we are looking in some of the future substation sites, starting to do the legwork in areas what we would call non-residential. And we have more specifics about that I'll touch on later. I've already mentioned this, but we have been doing quite a bit of work already with our stakeholders. You'll hear some information. Some of the substations, when we're transmission, you know, if it's not already there, we'll have to look at considerations around those type of options and routing. And then kind of close this out talking about with the amount of substation work we see, looking through some strategies on how to order long lead time items, not only so we get them in the queue, but possibly get better pricing as well. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Chad for a bit, who's going to specifically speak to the three substations being worked on.
So the first one here on the list is we're calling it OMI substation. This is in the old station area just north of where Stemelt's expansion is there. So last year, PUD in coordination and collaboration with Stemelt was able to acquire about an acre piece of property that was in their expansion parcel there to build a substation in that on that piece of property. And this substation's purpose will be, one, to provide additional capacity in this whole kind of old station, northern Wenatchee area. In addition, there's an existing substation, old station substation, that's just north of this that has been assessed nearing end of life. So there's some things that are indicating that it's a priority for replacement. So it is our currently top priority replacement substation. We recognize that this is a critical area because of all the industrial in there. So one of the things I did want to mention about this station is typically we'll recommend constructing a substation that would be able to facilitate or accommodate two banks or two transformers in there so that it could be double banked in the future. We're going to be bringing forward staff's recommendation to actually start off with two transformers in here. There's some advantages to that growth-wise for maintenance purposes, also for contingency, so the any capacity would be readily available in the event that something did occur. And because this is an industrial area, it probably makes sense. So we'll be bringing that forward, not that issue in particular on its own, but it will be incorporated into when we are purchasing power transformers. So we'll do a contract for a certain amount of transformers to put into each one of these substations. So we'll make sure that we mention that. And then it'll increase. We're working through what the costs are now. And the design is now, but it'll increase the budget item that's currently in the forecast by maybe 20%, something like that.
Chad, with two transformers in there, what would the capacity be then at full operational?
Well, capacity, we've been playing around with the capacity issue a lot, especially with HDLs, right? So energy consumption is not equal. Right, industrial is different from residential, which is different from HDL. So we'll be doubling the capacity of that station, but that doesn't necessarily mean that twice or two times 28 MVA or 56 megawatts would be available for all sectors. So we're working through the details of that when we're trying to understand a little bit better what our availability is for our existing stations and then any new stations too. So those allocations through the HDL process and large load process will start to precipitate themselves out. But we're looking at about 50%, just for example. So,
but a big chunk of that's already spoken for. It's to melt, right?
It's almost all spoken for. All of the 28, the original one, which is why we started thinking, boy, we should probably put a second one in there at the same time, and that might make a lot of sense. So.
Yeah.
Did you want to touch on the current stage?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so current stage right now is we're doing plan and profile design, meaning what does the bus work look like? What's the fence look like? Those are all prerequisites to submitting the conditional use permit, which is another public process that will be worked through with the city. And it's about 190 to 120 day process from when it gets submitted. The challenge, and we'll talk about permitting with some of these other ones, but maybe I'll just mention this right now, is the conditional use permit requires several things about the design to be done. What is the landscaping going to look like? What's the fence going to look like? What's the lighting going to look like? Those are all design attributes. So you got to get pretty far down into the design aspects of these stations before you are actually ready to submit the conditional use permit for processing. And then there's an open public period part to that conditional use process also. We anticipate we're spending some time on scheduling and things now as we're going through the design, but we hope to be doing construction in 2019 and be taking delivery in the fall of 2019 on major equipment. Actual energization might slide into 2020 somewhere in there, but we're working on that now. Working on the schedule for that now. Okay, so the second one here is in Leavenworth, and this will probably be the second one that we work on, and that's what our plan and forecast looks like. So we're also doing plan view drawings on this. We hope to submit the conditional use permit later on this year, maybe even into next year. But then this station construction will follow 1 year after the previous one, the OMI substation. So we're looking at somewhere around 2020. There's a re-engagement of the community outreach in Q3. There's some significant parts to the station, including a significant amount of transmission. So we've worked with, TICA's worked with the stakeholders, transmission, and selected the preferred route. But once we get closer to do detailed design and construction, we'll want to re-engage the group, in addition to the permitting process, also here with the conditional use permit process. Anything else there, John?
And that's with the county?
That would be with the county, yeah. The county line, county city line is right there at Chumstig. North Shore substation. So this will be the third one. As long as we're going to be designing and constructing these sequentially, we'll be looking at construction in 2021. Again, it'll probably go into 2022 for energization, but it'll start in the fall. So this one, properties is working diligently to bring definition to the various to the parcel that we bought, because the parcel that was negotiated out with the property owner has to be perfected out of the larger property. So working through the property specifics associated with that, once that gets completed, we'll understand what the parcel looks like, and we'll begin to start design work on there. This is going to be a critical one for us to re-engage the stakeholders from an aesthetic standpoint. Board made sure that it was known that we understood what the aesthetics concerns were here with the adjacent property owner. So we want to incorporate some things into the design and landscaping of this where we can do some hiding and maybe some additional things that we haven't done in the past. So we're looking forward to working through what that looks like on the Chelan. This one, very little transmission component, although there will be some transmission, is located just a couple hundred yards or 100 yards away from the existing transmission line.
Question on the current 87% load. Is this particular substation more heavily loaded in the summertime than wintertime?
The Manson, the stations around this area, because there's a lot of irrigation, it's still winter peaking, but it's pretty high in the summertime also because of the amount of irrigation that's going on in the Manson-Wapato area.
Yeah, I just wondered, with all the second homes where the heat's turned down in the wintertime, I wondered if that...
The load characteristics are definitely different for the circuits in Chelan than they are for in Wenatchee because of what you what you're saying there. We're putting some more work into understanding what that looks like, because that will affect how we plan for capacity.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge that I get concerned about is if you don't get that diversity correct, in other words, if you plan for only a certain amount of people being there, and then all of a sudden everything hits right, it's cold, it's Christmas vacation, and there's a lot more people than you expected to be there, you want to make sure that you've got the capacity to adequately serve. So it's a challenge, but the load profiles are different.
Chad, what makes the priority of Leavenworth over North Shore or Lake Chelan? I'm just curious.
I don't know that it would be so much priority as the timing. So we're still working through property issues on the North Shore, trying to perfect that, and that's quite a process to get through. The one in Leavenworth, the Bavarian substation, the entire parcel was purchased, so the parcel was perfected out and described. So we're able to move forward quicker. So it's more of a timing issue of the various things getting done than it is a priority.
Thank you. Commissioner, I also think that the board's commitments about reengaging on the aesthetics at the North Shore substation site will cause some of that planning, design, and the conditional use permitting process to take longer than it might otherwise.
I'm not actually sure what that's going to look like. So we're not sure what it's going to look like. It'll take some time to develop out.
So over the past year or so, Chad and his team have looked a little further into the future. Just again, lesson learned from trying to do just-in-time type construction and property acquisition. So this is, aside from the three that are already in the works, these are 10 more sites. Now, one caveat, this is the point in time right now, and it's based on the priority need. But certainly over the years, they could shift around a little bit based upon growth trends and whatnot. Out of these 10, we have two that currently we own the property. One is the Castle Rock It's across Western at the end of Castle Rock Street. We've had that property for, I think, at least 10 years. It's one where we've had the signs been placed on the lot saying a future home. But it has developed over the years, so we understand when we re-engage on that, it'll be some effort. The other one, Simmer, is part of the Cashmere system. It is actually a substation right now. It's the last 4KV system that we anticipate probably over the next year or two fully being on our normal voltage. But that we're looking at a new substation in Cashmere with the growth that's happened, even with the recent substation from 3 years ago. Going down the line, and I'm going to call out the Eniant substation specifically, as well as the Wenatchee, that the number one. But South Shore and the Chelan area, there's a lot of growth going on around that area. So we anticipate working to find a site. This is when their transmission will be a bit of a challenge, or just routing it through there, just because it's not really in close proximity. So it's something to work through. We've had very high-level discussions with the city, but again, we anticipate having to supply another station there. Other areas around Lake Chelan include the Manson area, as well as more further north in the Howard Flats area. Another one we're looking at is kind of going down towards Malaga, the Stamilk Creek area, and then future plans and Mission Ridge and some of the development we're seeing up around the Heights or the Forest Ridge area. We anticipate needing a substation. That one, too, would have some transmission work to consider. And then the further south one would be one around Rock Island Dam. So, again, this is a longer-term view, but it just when you look at the growth trends and the zoning, right now that seems to make the most sense.
Couple of maybe before we get off this, so just one of the things that I wanted to mention here was what I've learned is that we're really good at identifying where these substations are going to be needed. We're not as good as understanding when. So with all of the Growth Management Act work that's done with zoning properties, and as long as the loads are consistent, meaning we don't have new type loads that add to our system, it's we can understand pretty closely what we're going to need for electrical infrastructure. What we don't understand is when those areas are going to grow. So by identifying where these things are going to be needed and what we're going to need and making some advancements towards that, maybe even acquiring the property, then we can wait and let the actual growth determine the when.
I wanted to talk specifically about a couple of the sites that we're looking at. This is what we're calling Wenatchee 2. This is just down the road, I would call it, just a little bit south of the Pybus Market, probably in between the footbridge and the market. We have a current station there right now. It's a pretty critical station for us. It's kind of right in the core of downtown. It's a capacity. We need to do something. It has 6 feeders coming out of it, which is a bit unusual. Typically, we have 4 feeders. There's some property that's available, so our real estate group is doing a market analysis. We've talked to the city about this. They've actually, you know, they recognize the need and are in support. So this is what I want to just bring out, that we are looking at potentially acquiring some property. It makes a lot of sense. It's right next to the existing. With 6 feeders, you immediately can gain some benefit without having to do 4 feeders. But it is a pretty critical situation or substation area that we want to act on. So with that, I just might pause on this one, see if you have any questions about this. Chad, you had anything from your perspective?
Is that a one transformer with future expansion? Is that the plan?
We would probably add, yeah, plan for larger capacity. The second one is Eniant, and I see we have Mr. Chambers in the crowd who's been helpful. As the city of Eniant's been really helpful because they see the need and they have some growth plans. And in that area, we actually have some property that was acquired years ago that is now very nice ball fields, and the city's made it clear that, you know, it's a community asset, and they appreciate that. But that being said, we are still looking into the future and
realizing we need to add a station. So we've been working with them on what would be alternative properties. This area, too, again, there's one that's for sale. It's just right next to the existing station. It's kind of in that corridor. Transmission's right there. So it's a property we want to explore pretty hard to see if that would be feasible. Let's kind of close out. We're almost there, but just some other items of interest and maybe just to restate a few things. Again, right now we're currently looking at what our options are, primarily in non-residential areas. We would anticipate if we landed on what would be a reasonable price, would make sense operationally, engineering standpoint, we would come back and seek to gain approval on a purchase or an option with maybe some sort of community outreach for a limited duration to gain feedback. But just sensing that we need to acquire some land and start that planning process, that's what we kind of like to get a little bit of feedback on if that works for the board. We certainly don't want to catch anybody off guard. And I think what we learned from the last time, I'll use the city of Leavenworth, for example, it was very clear up front with the city that we needed the property and they endorsed it. And, you know, I think that process, although it took more time than I would have liked, we got through it fairly smooth.
Gary. Sean, I just have a question with respect to working with county and municipal planners. Does any of that involve conversations about maybe developers who are coming into an area and building out large housing or industrial developments somehow being involved in that conversation to provide for substation location or anything like that?
We've heard that from the county. I think they've acknowledged that they'd like to support us in that arena. Again, just from general planning as well.
Yeah.
Chad has a slide later, but Andy and Chad have been very active in engaging those folks. We've not only at the commission and board level, council level, we've had those conversations, but now I think we're getting down into the planning aspect with a lot of good traction that I certainly haven't seen for a while. I know some of these agencies have gone through some staff turnover, and we're working through that, but I think it's a they understand the need, and they definitely want to support us. That's my perspective.
That's great. That's wonderful.
Another thing, since we are looking at, you know, purchasing some land, it's nothing we really put in our budget for this year. We do have some flexibility, but just want to let you know if we do acquire some property and if our budget requires a revision, we may be back. Something new, and with the amount of substations, even the three we've talked about, one being a double bank, potentially acting on some others, we're looking to understand what we would call an approval process to do a multi-year order, multi-quantity for those long lead time items. We've seen from other utilities that those options provide pretty good pricing and some certainty as you move forward having those items in the queue. What we don't want to do is do a budget revision for everything, but that kind of skew our budget a bit, but have the approval so it's well known what we're doing. This is a key, and we'll pause on this one too. So the two things, with the amount of substations we're looking at potentially in the future, there are some alternative construction methods. Similar to the GCCM that you've heard from facilities, another one out there is called progressive design build, and that's where if you have a critical mass of properties and equipment in the queue, you can move through the construction phase quite quickly, much faster than what you've seen with the three substations we're working on. We recently had an opportunity to visit Grant County, and I think they did, was it eight stations? Eight stations in 18 months. They had some really good lessons learned. We took a full notebook of notes, but they were very forthcoming in sharing their information. So it's very intriguing with just the amount of work that's ahead of us to look at that option. We're not there yet, but having properties and, again, the long lead time items, some options around that sets that up. Internally, we still need to understand what does it take to manage that process, but at least this is kind of a step forward to have that.
That was our biggest takeaway, I think, from the grant. In order for that to even work for them, they had to have the major equipment and the property already. That's the only way it works. So that was one of our takeaways. So for us to try to put ourselves in a position having a multi-year, multi-asset contract together for several power transformers to be delivered over a few years or a period of time, and then acquiring properties would set us up so that if we had to, we would have a better chance of utilizing some sort of an alternative delivery method like that.
And following up on Commissioner Arsenault's comment, we are we continue to meet with the county and municipal planning folks. There's one scheduled on June 20th of this month. It's going to be focused a lot on the whole crypto HDL, but certainly the substation piece is a big part of that as well. And Chad's going to give that presentation tomorrow at the Tri-Commission, but this is one of the main slides out of it, so we thought we'd share that.
So the topics of discussion, and then the county and the municipalities planners will bring some of the discussion points that they want to work through. We're trying to figure out this, you know, growth trends and future projections. How do we want to use the existing infrastructure, and how do we plan for future infrastructure? What is the HDL impacts? Land zoning, where zoning is changing. So a lot of the folks, municipalities in the county, are always contemplating changes to their zones. What does that mean, and what are they trying to accomplish with that, and how does that affect what we've already got, what plans that were already in place? And then trying to identify substation sites and options, and maybe even getting those identified in their long-range plans where we would have utility infrastructure, so that at least maybe it doesn't get acquired, but maybe it gets identified, like this area we would need a substation. So at least it begins to communicate to folks that there will be a facility required in that general area. And maybe we can even get to a point where we're doing some joint property acquisition, or at least siting of some facilities that best meets their community's plans.
So over the last 10 years, on average, how many new substations have we put in?
About one a year, but, you know, some years we've done two. And
so the average has been one a year, and you've got a list of your top 10 current potential, which is only a 10-year window.
Right. So
maybe less.
One of the differences where we are today is in the 90s, we shifted into a just-in-time construction kind of philosophy, right? So we were utilizing more percentage of our available capacity. So we were looking at ways, especially in 2008, in order to manage our expenses. And so in order for us to do that, we were utilizing more and more capacities. So I think our risks profile has gone up a little bit because we have less and less capacities available, which means we're going to have to be a little bit more nimble and put some other things in place, like this progressive design build, to ensure that we've got the capacity there and we could build quicker than what we would have had to in the past.
I'd just have a whole lot higher level of comfort if we had all 10 pieces of those property in hand right now and we're looking at the next 10.
Yep. Yeah.
So I think so. One commissioner's feedback.
That would be mine too.
Yeah. Seen lots of nods.
Yeah, great. A lot of nods on that.
So one of the other things, there's not a property component to that, but this is just stations that are necessary for growth. We also have stations that we are going to be recommending based on our asset management principles and the risks and conditions associated with those assets. For example, the old station substation. So that's the OMI substation is a growth and a conditional substation. So there's another list of substations too. So we got a lot of substation work in our future.
And this really doesn't include any future decisions on HDL or the crypto discussion as well.
Okay.
Just a further question. As I'm seeing in my mind's eye, how the length of time, the lead time to acquire the land, the missing component is that I don't have an answer to. How long from the time that you place an order to buy a transformer till the time it's on the ground and functioning? What's that lead time?
The lead time from receipt of order to delivery is 12 to 15 months on a power transformer. Some of the other larger equipment is similar to that. So, you know, probably looking at 24 months total from the time you get a contract for procuring the long lead time items, then about a three-month construction period, civil and electrical construction, equipment delivery, and then commission and testing, energization is probably about 24 months. And that would be somewhat compressed. But if you could start property acquisition, maybe a three-year process for permitting procurement. One of the things that always messes things up just a little bit from a timing standpoint is seasonality. Doing a lot of concrete work and earthwork and dirt work in the wintertime is just not it's tough. It's doable, and you'd have to, but it increases your costs and delays and draws out the schedule. So from an efficiency standpoint, we prefer to hit sort of the summer and fall months. And in doing so, it always adds a few months to the project schedule.
So would it be safe to assume then that this list of 10 is actually a 20-year project?
Yeah.
Not a 10-year project.
Unless we looked at some sort of a progressive design.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But again, having those property rights and the equipment in the queue is the key to that.
Right.
Grant went through theirs. They did a lot of construction during that winter, not last winter, but the winter before when we had that 0-degree weather, and they suffered through it, but did it.
Just curious, where does all this large equipment manufactured these days?
Around the world, really. I think there's now about six or eight major power transformers, kind of the bigger players. There's a couple of them within the United States. The last few that we've bought are out of Mexico City. So, there's several.
Didn't that big one up at Monitor, didn't that come out of Korea?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Wheeled in on a massive truck. I don't know how many people saw that.
Took one of my grandsons to watch that.
They shut down the roads. It took it like three days to get here from Seattle because they had to block the highway all the way.
We had to trim trees and move power lines. And
wow.
And they took it through downtown Kashmir because the overpasses were too low. And I mean, quite an event.
Okay. Other thoughts, comments, questions? Yeah, gentlemen, thank you. And I think the inclination of the board, and we'll work that through Steve. Let's go.
Thank you.
John, before you leave,
been there.
I'll just sit next to you there. It's a nice opportunity. It's kind of a couple of watershed moments in a person's career, and John Stoll's been with us for 20 years. So this is your 20-year pin. We're grateful to have you and appreciate your contributions.
Well, thank you. Great. 20 years goes by pretty quick. But again, I appreciate this is a great organization. When I started out my career 20 years ago as a system accountant, you would have told me I'd be doing this. But it's been great. It's just been an awesome experience. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, John.
I want to invite Janet and John up. We're going to talk a little bit about Lake Chelan water levels.
Good afternoon, and I'm Janet Jaspers, Energy Planning and Trading Manager, and John Wasniewski, Energy Analyst.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. We received a lot of water in the month of May. We had a record-breaking month of sorts at both Lake Chelan in terms of inflows into the lake as well as on the Columbia River at Rocky Reach. At Lake Chelan, the average monthly inflow was just over 10,000 CFS, which is the highest monthly average that we have on record for Lake Chelan. for the month of May, which dates back to 1929, and on the Columbia River, the average monthly flow for May was nearly 275,000 CFS, which again is the highest we've seen for a monthly average in May that we have on record, which for Rocky Reach dates back to 1962. So a lot of water received in May. And I'll talk about Lake Chelan a little more here and then a bit about the Columbia River.
There it is.
So for Lake Chelan, the lake is currently at 1,096.6 feet. We have met our May 1st and June 1st target elevation. We're in good shape to meet the remaining target elevations. We gave a little bit different look here to show how much water we expect to receive in the inflow period of April 1st to July 31st, as well as how much we have received to date. And we broke that down in feet of water and then what we've done with the water we've received up to this point. So since April 1st, we've filled the lake 10.9 feet. We've also generated with about 5.8 feet of water, and we've spilled 6.8 feet. And based on 120% water supply forecast, that we estimate there's about 14.5 feet of water remaining in the Lake Chelan drainage basin left to enter before July 31st.
By the way, I really like that. That's a new graphic with the feet. That's layman's language.
Yeah, credit to Janet on that one. She helped me come up with this, a good way to communicate.
No, and I looked at that online. That was a nice eye-opener and really clear graphic. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you. And then for the Columbia River, the water supply forecast remains pretty near 125%. I think this morning when I checked, it was 122% of average. And then on the 120-day inflow forecast, you can see the yellow line there is the actual inflows. You can see where there's the really high flows for the month of May that we've seen. And then the black line is the forecasted inflows for the next 120 days. As you can see, according to this forecast, it looks like we're kind of past that peak period of heavy flows on the river. Not sure if Janet, you want to add?
What is the CFS right now on the Columbia for us?
Today it should be about 240,000 CFS for a daily average, and kind of that same for the rest of the week.
All right. Thank you very much.
And just to add a little bit to what John said, this kind of pale green line that you see that's kind of close to 150, 160, 70,000, that's a 30-year normal. And so this, the yellow flows that we saw here kind of from mid-May to the end of May, even till right now, are almost double our normal flow.
Any questions about Lake Chelan or flows on the river? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to do a quick update. So there's a group of public power utilities in the West that have been meeting for the last couple of years, talking about just the different kinds of issues that are coming up out here. Occasionally we get together and try to work together to see if we can agree on a set of principles. We have agreed recently on a set of principles regarding California. So we are very much concerned with the evolution of the market in California. There's currently an energy imbalance market that operates. They're talking about, which is hour ahead, talking about extending that to day ahead. Most of the transactions in the West occur day ahead today. So you're taking maybe 5% of the transactions that occur within the hour and translating it to much more than half the transactions that potentially would be covered by this market. And there's also something called the reliability coordinator. Every region has to have a coordinator to look at reliability so that each of us that are operating our own balancing authorities can see how we're connected to others. The existing reliability coordinator has got some cost issues. So the California ISO has proposed becoming the reliability coordinator for the West. So these are pretty dramatic expansions in terms of the authority for that organization. We've had a lot of concern about that because ultimately the California Independent System Operator the board is nominated by the governor and approved by the legislature. So you have this political overlay of representing a specific set of constituencies within the West that would be controlling a significant part of Western power markets. I'm just going to refer you to the first five of these 10 principles and say the one thing that public power entities across the West could agree on, this includes public power entities that are in California and operating with the California Independent System Operator and have say in it, that if we're moving towards some sort of regional transmission organization, which would be a something that would control the markets in the West broadly, it needs to be independent and non-affiliated. That really critical. We have to move away from nomination by the governor of a particular state and confirmation by the legislature of that state. Clearly defined process for election, for selection of the board, nominating committee with a role for public power in that nomination process. Strong member advisory committee. So there are other regional transmission organizations across the United States. They're organized in a variety of different ways. The one that we find most appealing is what's called the Southwest Power Pool, where they have a very strong member advisory committee that sits with the board for every decision that it makes so that they hear directly from the members what the interests and concerns are. And, so we're looking for something like that. Strong role on key issues like resource adequacy. Resource adequacy is making sure that we are not relying so much on spot markets because energy prices are cheap today, and there's a tendency for utilities to say, well, energy is cheap and I can buy it for 5 years, so I'm just going to buy it. Then you get into a crisis and you can't buy for longer than that, and all of a sudden the prices go crazy. So we support the idea of there being adequacy standards, that there has to be every load-serving entity has to have a responsibility to make sure it has enough resource to serve its load and out in a longer period of time so that people who are selling capacity, like us, will get fair value for that. Candidly, we can live in the other world, but the problem is when the prices go crazy and we get paid a bunch of money, people think that's unfair. And we say, well, no, wait a second, we've been getting underpaid for a lot of years, and that's because of the way the market was set up. We would prefer a market that was stable and produced fair prices through time rather than ones that went up and down a lot.
That's interesting. That's the same proposition our customers came with to us about 7 years ago and said, do what you need to do with rates, but can we do it consistently? Can we do it over time? Can we plan on it?
Right.
So same philosophy.
That's right. That's right. We just think that anything, this fifth bullet point is really about governance, that there just needs to be a strong role for the states and other market participants in the decision-making process. So I just wanted you to be aware. There is a bill that's pending in the California legislature now that addresses the future the RTO ISO. The purpose is that there are many folks in California who understand it might be to their advantage to broaden the role of the ISO because they have a lot of surplus. They have a lot of renewables, a lot of surplus at certain times. If they could diversify their supply across a bigger base, it should lead to lower costs. Those of us on the outside are saying, well, if you're going to do that, then you've got to move towards changing the governance structure. So we'll see where that goes. There's an interestingly environmental community in California is split with a strong contingent that supports independence and a change to the governance structure. And so we find ourselves working with them right now. So wanted you to be aware of this, particularly as we head towards APPA. I know this will be a subject at the LPPC meeting this upcoming week among the Western folks, and I would expect this may get discussed in some of your meetings as well.
Steve, is there any adoption of concern by the Western governors outside of the state of California that entities residing in, let's say, Washington might have to be answered to California legislators ultimately?
Not in the sense of an organized Western Governors Association resolution, but if you speak to folks in different states, and I know there is a concern in Washington state about this because we've had conversations with the governor's office about it, yes is the answer.
Great. On the radar. Mm-hmm.
Unless there are questions, that's it for that item. And I believe that's it for our manager's items for today.
Regarding commissioner items, are there commissioner items? I have one.
I have one brief. But...
Okay. Randy, why don't you go ahead?
It may not be directly affiliated with utility, but it's part of who I am. As we speak, or maybe just a few minutes ago, Keith Gaynor and Mike Caputa just wrapped up a meeting with the Kyrgyz ambassador in Washington, D.C.
Oh.
They were to meet at 4 o'clock this afternoon, Washington, D.C. time. So I'm guessing that they're probably done with their meeting. So
that could have some
furthering our Chelan County relationship with Kyrgyzstan.
Other items? A couple of weeks ago, I had a conversation with City Councilman Jim Bailey related to the mutual concerns related to waterfront parking. And anytime you have a conversation with Commissioner Bailey, who I've known for, we actually found out we ran cross country against each other in college, so it's been a while. Jim is very astute and represented the council's viewpoint very clearly and articulately, and it's one we need to hear, as well as he agreed the council needs to hear our position related to that issue. Both of us had the realization that the city council and the beauty commission have never met in a formal setting, and so there was an expressed desire on both of our parts to do that. And then center at least our initial discussion around the waterfront parking issues. If that meets with your agreement, then I'll work with Rebecca and whomever sets the agenda or timing at the city. And if that is the desire of this commission.
I think that can be nothing but good. I think that can be good.
Yeah, no, I think it can be. So, and also, Mayor Kuntz is interested. In the two commission and council coming together and having conversation and getting to know each other, and you know, we have overlapping representation and that we're representing the same people, and it would be good for us to understand that. Okay. So and I think as an example in Chelan, it's been very helpful to have a relationship with the city council and the mayor that has furthered some issues. And so with that, Rebecca will keep me on the straight and narrow, and we'll get something
out. I'll chime in and just make one addition to this comment with respect to parking down by the waterfront. Went to the gym, what used to be Gold's Gym, across from Pybus on Saturday, and one of their employees was out at the entrance to the parking lot checking to see if you have a gym membership number to use the parking lot.
Wow.
Because their parking lot is being used by Pybus people. So that definitely points to being a problem just with individual businesses as well.
Other thoughts? Other commission items? Commissioner Travel?
Commissioner Travel. Yep. I'm going to present your commissioner travel today as Lisa's away from the office. So... Rebecca Garfine, Clerk of the Board, for those listening. The next upcoming event is the APPA Annual Conference in New Orleans. We show Commissioner Arsenault, McKenna, and Smith departing on June 14th. Commissioner Bowles and Congdon departing on June 17th. The return also has a couple of dates, with Commissioner Congdon returning on the 20th and Commissioners Arsenault, Bowles, McKenna, and Smith returning on the 21st. Anyone have any concerns with those travel dates?
Joyce Lynn, I'll be returning later, but that's the information that I gave you today for alternate travel.
Okay.
Other thoughts?
All right. Okay. And then we also, also coming up in June on the 28th, Commissioner Congdon will be attending the quarterly water committee meeting in Olympia. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions or updates on future travel? It's missing.
I may not end up being at the Waputa meeting in July. My wife and I were just looking at July's schedule last night. Something has to go. So
I'd be happy to take your New Orleans trip.
That's June. But yeah, something's going to have to give in there. And we have a new dog, and I'm not sure she'd recognize us by August. So, but anyway, no, there's just so we'll talk. We'll keep that in mind, and we're still deciding.
Great.
Anything else? Our travel. Thank you. Follow-up delegation item 18.
We just had one, and that was the item to get back to you on the public power benefit program regarding the position for developmentally disabled candidate. So I think we've got that one nailed, and, hopefully move on to the next set.
Okay. 19, delegation of action items.
I got two from this meeting on Arondo River Park. So we've got community survey results to get back to you. I think we've got a question regarding that was asked of the port regarding further clarity around their RCO obligations, and in particular, since Lisa Park said that they believe that the capital obligations would be lower than what we showed in the numbers here, I think we need to define what lower means. So what is it that it can be dropped from that plan that we thought we were going to be operating to? How much costs are we talking about? So we'll get to work on that and hopefully be able to get back to you by the next meeting.
What's our time frame? When's our action item coming up on this? What's our time frame?
Well, for decision? We put the plan in place for 2018, and we're operating under the 2018 plan. I think it's really just a matter of the earlier you have certainty, the better off you are, but there's not really a deadline that forces us to take action probably until later this year. But we'd like to not keep coming back to it and going over it, to be honest. We'd like to figure it out and move on.
Steve, has there been any feedback at our other camping parks from people that used to stay at the Arondo Park that are now being put off into the other parks that we have for camping? Do we have any feedback on how big of an impact that's been?
I think we'd have to check on that one. I haven't heard anything, but I would be best off to follow up and let you know.
The question I had that goes with that I didn't think about until after they left. In the survey from the community, camping was a high priority for them. It surprised me, if I remember my data correctly, that was one of their priorities and their benefits. And I was just curious if the port had any, or our staff had any feedback from local community members, not just regular campers, but local community members when they got the notice that camping was closed. Did we get much feedback? I was just curious.
Check and see on that, but I will say nothing has made it to my desk so far.
And so, just tagging on here, as I remember, the initial survey results showed that a really high percentage, I think I remember over 90% of the usage of that park is from out of the area, right?
And it was very high.
Mm-hmm. And the camping is primarily from people out of the area. So we are supporting camping and usage of the park for people out of the area.
Really be interested to see what this year looks like, looking back at the end of the year, mm-hmm. in terms of park usage and demographics, local, that type.
But that answers the question on the time frame for decision making. Okay.
If I can, just throw one more question out there, since we're talking about this. I thought I heard Lisa say that the, and I should have asked her this question to clarify, that part of the capital expense and changes that they were looking into might include the demolition of the restroom. And if that's the case, then we're changing the face of the park entirely. Right. There's no longer will have camping, it won't have a restroom, it'll be just a bunch. And so then the question is, from the locals' perspective, what's their opinion of that park? Does it still maintain the objective that they see the park was designed for?
I think they have to have a restroom by law.
Well, and
Do they not?
Just for practicality, you can't have a boat launch and beer and not have a restroom.
No, I mean, if they're going to demolish the restroom,
Well, that's one of their capital expenses.
It is, but apparently they're going to build another restroom.
For the sake of time, we can continue this.
I think the problem is that we don't really know what it will spend less money. So I'd like to go understand that
better. So, moving on, Steve, I need to ask you a question in terms of executive session. Do you have an approximation on the time frame?
About 60 minutes.
60? Okay. Let's move to item 20, which is additional public comment.
Is that Nick?
It's Nick.
Nick has been waiting. He's been here all day long.
Come on up, Nick.
Learning a little bit more about process, so it's all been a very informative day, but
albeit long. And
Well, I'll try to keep it short, because
Nick, let me speak to the process, okay? Because I think that's important.
Yeah.
Related to the issue of the moratorium, we've established a pretty firm public process for taking comment, and it's been deliberate in doing so to create transparency. Because, as you well know, there are people on both sides of this issue, and for them to have an opportunity to present in a forum where they're facing each other and have that open opportunity to communicate has been a critical piece. And so, to a certain extent, this is a one-off. And I want to be able to allow you to have some time to do that. But yet, I'm also asking at the same time that there ultimately be respect for the process of those people who not only would perhaps be favorable to what you're going to say today, those who are maybe opposed to that would have the opportunity in the flesh to be here if it was a known item on the agenda. So, so I'm asking to be respectful of that process. With that being said, you also wrote a very nice in full explanation of your talking points today. Those have been published, handed to the commissioners. Anything that you send to us in writing is kept. It's online. It's accessible. And so that's kind of the vein that we would like to go forward with.
Okay.
And with that being said, in fairness to people who spoke before, I am going to limit you to 4 minutes, and we'll go from there.
Yeah.
And again, thank you for your patience.
Yeah. Well, and thank you for allowing me to speak with you, especially considering all of those factors that you were discussing. I guess, and if people are looking at the document that I typed up, that's pretty much, what I wanted to talk about. That this process, I did a lot of research to try to figure out if this would work. In order to file the application, had to go through with a bid on a property. When you do the bid on the property, you have to do additional work, as far as getting professionals to look at the property to make sure that you want to buy it. I mentioned in that document that, I got this offer from the State Department for a job that had a very short turnaround as far as the decision, whether I wanted to go with that job or not. And I guess, it's still a little surprising to me that Chelan PUD thinks that, you could create a moratorium and apply it to applications that were pending at the time. I don't think it's unreasonable for me to feel that. I really felt like the rug was pulled out from underneath me when I found out that the moratorium was in place and then it was applying to my application. I still kind of can't believe that's been allowed to happen. Now, I understand that there's a lot of constraints. There's a lot of burdens that are being placed on the grid and on the system, by these applications. But I guess, this is my life. I made that move. And I made it, after I did all of the research and talked to all the stakeholders. And now I'm just in limbo. And, beyond that, and I understand in talking, you know, reading the emails and in your comments, you know, that it has to be an open process. But I guess it was a little frustrating in terms of, you know, my takeaway from the April 2 meeting that I went to was, you know, there could be some sort of movement at the May 14 hearing. And so, you know, my goal was try to be heard and try to get some of this information, like what was in that document, mm-hmm. presented to staff and considered so that there was an option at that hearing, you know, when it's public, to get some sort of movement and some sort of flexibility. And it didn't really feel like that was the process. I talked to a lot of people, but no one was really involved in, you know, formulating the motion that was presented at the hearing, which was a little bit frustrating. And I guess, you know, I just would like to reiterate what I brought up at the April 2 meeting that I went to, and that I'm really hoping that there will be some flexibility. You know, like in the, I think I mentioned before that I'm a lawyer. And in the legal context, you know, there are extenuating circumstances. And where a judge sees something happening that's going to be inherently unfair based on the totality of the circumstances, he or she can modify the treatment of a party to make sure that it is fair, make sure that it isn't quite so unjust. I don't think that my situation is going to be very similar to many other pending applicants in terms of coming in, buying a property, you know, making life changes that are affected. And what I'm hoping is that there's some sort of way that the staff and board could consider, you know, those extenuating circumstances to produce something that would allow my application to proceed. And, you know, that's really all I wanted to express today. So thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you, Nick. Appreciate it very much. Well said. Thank you.
I just have a comment, Mr. Chairman. Yes. Am I in order here?
Yes, you are.
To Nick.
Yes, please.
I just want to say I read through this, as we all did, read through it a second time. I feel for you. I feel really badly. I'm, for one, Commissioner, I'm definitely giving this second thoughts. I hope we can get our heads together and come to terms and... this is a tough situation. I feel for you.
Yeah. And I think, Ann, I would choose a different word. I would say additional thought, not a second thought. But that's it. That's why we have different opinions. Hey, item 21, matters of general business to come before the commission. Hearing none. We will go to item 23-2, which is an executive session, to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district court's board is or is likely to become a party and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 482.30.111I to consider the selection of a site or the acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase when the public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause a likelihood of increase in price as authorized by RCW 42.30.111B to consider the minimum price at which real estate will be offered for sale or lease when public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause likelihood of a decreased price as authorized by RCW 42.30111C for approximately 60 minutes. We will start at 2:15 and conclude at 3:15. This is Sherland County Board of Commissioners coming back out of executive session into regular session. During executive sessions, no decisions were made, no votes were taken. Is there any further business to come before the commission? Hearing none. 3:20, we're adjourned. 3:20, we're adjourned. 3:20, we're adjourned. 3:20, we're adjourned. 3:20.